Arizona Board of Technical Registration Legislation and Rules Committee to order.
Okay, all you soft-spoken people.
Sorry.
Not that we have anyone in the gallery.
All right. Do I need to officially read all of this lead-in stuff? That's good. I'll have a roll call, please.
Leroy Brady?
Here.
Jason Foos? William Greenslade?
Here.
Robert Stanley?
Here.
Edward Marley?
Here.
Ronald Starling? We have a quorum.
Thank you. Call to the public. No one here. Adoption of minutes. Approve, modify, or reject the January 10, 2017 L&R committee minutes.
I move that we accept the minutes.
Okay, motion, do I have a second?
Second.
Any discussion? All those in favor, say aye.
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 Aye. Any opposed?
I wasn't here, so.
One abstention.
Not abstention, one abstention.
All right. Review, discussion, and possible action on the following. Board rules for revision 2017. We need to look at the Word document. I think that's the most current.
Yes.
I'm going to flip back and forth, though, because I have comments.
And again, I apologize for the third line at the top, which says September 30th, 2013.
Okay.
I know.
Oh.
It does.
I didn't see that.
Good. Okay. The changes in this Word document should reflect most of what we talked about at the last L&R meeting. Some things as I was going through I didn't like, and so we can certainly discuss those. And there were a couple of things that I wanted, since looking at these, that I thought maybe we should add that we didn't discuss last time, specifically like adding ethics language to what is unprofessional conduct, so just as a topic for discussion.
Okay.
I think on page one, when we look at professional experience, the new definition should reflect what we talked about at the last meeting. You gentlemen wanted to say it means a diversity of work necessary to ensure that good judgment is applied to protect the public during the course and scope of contracted projects.
Question on the use of the term contracted. Sometimes projects don't have a contract, yet they should still be bound by all of that stuff.
Do you want to take it out? We just say course and scope of projects?
I'm fine with just scope of projects.
Yeah.
Yeah?
I just don't want someone to come in here under an investigation and go, well, I don't fall under this because I didn't have a contract. You know, maybe they were doing some pro bono work for a charity and still screwed up and something went wrong.
Yeah.
And they end up before our board.
Now, I wonder, too, about the language of course and scope. Wondering.
Could you just say scope?
Or course.
Or course.
What do you think?
I'm not sure what that means.
Well, the way I saw it, course is kind of the process that you go through for a project. The scope is the work that you've been asked to do.
The work that you agreed to do. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's fine
as
is, personally. But
yeah.
I don't think it destroys it one way or the other.
Yeah.
It's kind of like...
covers them both.
Yeah.
The scope, what you're doing.
I'm okay with it. It seems a little awkward to me, but I'm okay with it.
Okay. And then the next weird thing is applicant/registrant. You guys probably don't remember that. And that's because when I looked at this, I thought these definitions should apply not just to the applicant, but to registrants as well.
Mm-hmm.
Because... sometimes when we get enforcement cases, we're looking to these definitions as well. Mm-hmm. And so I didn't want it just to apply to an applicant. What do you think?
Yeah,
that sounds good.
No problem.
Okay.
Good call.
Is there a category other than registrant?
Applicant.
No, applicant, yeah, but...
Certificate.
Yeah, I was going to say, does registrant, is that all-encompassing enough that it would cover our...
I think so. We refer to home inspectors.
Certificate holders.
As registrants.
And then I had a question on the use of and or registrant in 12.
Oh, yeah. Applicant and or. Well, I varied that day. You could see it was either before chocolate or after chocolate, where I had applicant / registrant or applicant and or registrant. Which do you prefer? I agree we should probably be uniform.
Slash.
Slash? Okay.
That's fine.
Less electrons.
Okay. And again, you know, Girk may hate this, but at least we have something. We added or equivalent offense in another jurisdiction.
Yep.
And then in 16, I'll take out the and or. There is an addition to the home inspector rule that I don't think you gentlemen looked at previously. It's on page 3. Number 5, we're defining the report checklist supplement, which is something the Home Inspector Committee had come up with several years ago that they created as a tool to help people applying go through their reports to make sure everything they felt was necessary was in there. So since we're not requiring them to use it, but we do have it on the website, I thought we should define it. So they were cool with this definition and...
Okay.
Is that Jason?
Yellow?
Yeah, is this L&R?
This is L&R.
It is. Welcome.
Hi, Jason.
L&R, Jason Foose is there.
Woohoo. We're on page 3 of the Word document. We're cruising.
Page 3 of the Word document.
Of the rules.
Okay. This is the one sent out Friday afternoon.
Yeah, it's the one I emailed you on Friday.
Okay, let me dig that up. I'm just looking at a set of rules right now. Let me dig that up, though. Who do we have in the room?
We have Ed. You want to do it?
Sure. So we have Mr. Greenslade, Mr. Brady, myself, Ed, Mr. Stanley, and Kurt, and Doug. Sorry.
No Patty.
No Patty.
No Patty. Find it.
Sent it to you Friday in a group email, I think addressed to one of your RLS Gmail accounts.
Yeah, I'm looking for that.
Okay. Do you want me to send it again?
I should have it here. Thank you. Okay. I'm up and running.
Great. I think we can skip over the drug lab crap.
Yeah.
Okay. So page six. Patty made me swear I would email up to DEQ and tell them I'm planning to strike all these rules.
See, page five, Amanda has the P's.
Ah, is it five or six?
Oh, it's six. I'm sorry. Okay. I have to touch, I scroll, and then I have to touch the screen to put it on the right page number. All right.
Okay. So, I think I...
Before we get to that, can I just ask one question? I'm sure you explained this before, but the rules for the home inspectors, or the definitions for the home inspectors, changed greatly,
yep.
Right? You took out a lot of stuff that is...
Yeah, they feel that all that stuff we've taken out is adequately addressed in what they call their standards of practice that the board has adopted. So they only wanted to include these five definitions of what a peer reviewer is and you know, all of that, because they think the other definitions are handled elsewhere.
Okay, well, that makes sense to me, and so thanks for that explanation. But so I'm fine with it, actually.
You are? Okay, good. All right. And they just looked at them last week, so they're good with it. Okay?
And there was some real good discussion.
They're an entertaining group. Yes.
They are.
Home inspectors?
Yes, yeah. they are. The three of them. Together. Yeah.
They're the same group that's been involved from the beginning?
They are. They're much. Really, really dedicated.
Yeah.
And if you ever need a home inspection, one of those three are the only ones I would refer to you. Anyway, I think I corrected the fees rule the way you gentlemen wanted it corrected. What do you think?
Is there a reason we're charging less for commercial purpose than for non-commercial purpose?
That's a good question.
Oh, one's a maximum fee and the other one's a minimum fee. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. That's.
Thank you for explaining that.
That's reasonable.
Okay.
I didn't catch that the first
time
I read it.
I didn't either. So I had the same question. But good.
All right. In D.
I have a question on the fees, though.
Okay.
Number five, recording medium copy. What is that?
That is a CD of
like
the board meeting.
Yeah, like they want an audio copy of a audio transcript of the board meeting and burn it to a CD or DVD.
And I think even if we don't do that, you still charge them for that amount either by
email it to it, sure.
Like
yeah. A lot of it, you know, it's funny because we have to resist the inclination to rewrite the entire rule, so that's like archaic language, but we've left it in so it doesn't look like we're making huge modifications.
Yeah. And number eight, mm-hmm. verification of registration or certification.
Yes,
what is
new.
That by whom?
The national councils often request verifications from us that their certificate holders are registered here, and other states often ask for verifications of exam scores or registration, and licensees often do as well. We're one of the only states in the country that doesn't charge for that. And so, considering in the past few years the substantial increase in the number of requests, we thought, let's see if we can charge for it. So that's a new fee.
This isn't the case where someone would call the board to see if someone is registered or not.
No, calling is free. It's if they request paper process. They want
a certified.
Right. They want like a crimped copy of their licensing information that we have to send somewhere for them. So we're recouping the time for staff to gather the records, and sometimes it's really time consuming because they have to go through the old board minute books to look and see where the lists were that indicate that person is registered because it wasn't recorded in the computer. So we have a lot of research time. We have the filling out of the paperwork time. We have the mailing costs. And
so I apply to state XYZ mm-hmm. and they want a verification. Mm-hmm. You're going to charge them $25 or me $25?
You.
So how do I mean, well, I guess I'm just trying to think of the logistics of how do I know that? That I'm going to have to pay somebody something. Because normally I'm applying everything to mm-hmm. state XYZ, and then state XYZ sends the thing to you saying, hey, is this guy registered? So then how does it get back to me?
XYZ state will probably charge you, and then we'll charge you. I don't know how XYZ states do it.
Yeah, I was just curious. All right, yeah.
But like if an applicant applies to us, we'll say, sure, for $25, we're happy to verify your exam scores and the date you were registered and the fact that you're in good standing and all that. So, mm-hmm. I mean,
yeah, it's
we
an
don't
expense.
Have to do it, guys. I threw it in there as a...
Well, my concern when I first read it is that I don't think it should be a burden on the public if they want to find out if someone is registered or not.
Right.
We shouldn't charge out for that.
So right.
that
would, you know. And we're going to be able to probably eliminate a lot of this with the new computer system. What I'm hoping is that we can just tell states and applicants, just go to our website and verify that this person is registered.
Yeah.
Because they'll be able to call up, hopefully, lots of information about the applicant or the registrant. You know, the fact they were registered here in 1987 or whatever the date is, and that should be good enough, but if they want staff to process paperwork and do all the rest, I thought to include it. And actually, legally, that's what we should be doing. We're currently not charging, but if we do charge, the public needs to know, as published in our rules, that we would be charging this fee. And actually, to be honest, this is probably something that the governor's office will be very seriously scrutinizing because it is a cost associated with registration. So we currently have one full-time employee that devotes probably half her time, 20 hours a week, to doing this kind of work.
Well, in terms of the cost, it seems to me that the board... The cost of running the board is paid by the registrants anyway, so it's not a public cost.
True.
So from that standpoint, I wouldn't be too concerned personally anyway about not recouping costs per se. But my main concern, as I said earlier, was I don't think it should be a burden for someone to want to know if a registrant is currently registered.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I think that ought to be easy for someone to mm-hmm. do.
And we still get calls like that up at the front desk all the time. And they'll look it up on the computer and say, yes, you know, XYZ person is registered in good standing if someone were to call. And I think they can look it up currently with our less than stellar website they're still in good standing that way. So that's free as well. Like I said, this would just be for the processing of an actual request for verification of registration. So
do we want to put that in processing of request for verification?
Sure. If you think it makes
it
more clear.
Make it a little more clear.
Melissa, does this involve a certification or some kind of authoritative statement if we're issuing these to other boards or the NCEES?
Yes. Yes. Usually they'll send us their particular form, and we have our particular form, which has, you know, the certifying language in it. This is an official document from blah, blah, blah board. We have people sign it. We can crimp it. So it's like an official public record.
So I guess, is there a regulatory or statutory basis for this, similar to what the recorder would use when they issue a certified copy?
Yes, but right now I can't think of the actual statute. I think it's probably in the powers and duties of the board, 32-106, where it says the board, you know, is the custodian, or maybe it's the executive director is the custodian of records for the board. That kind of language we would point to as the justification for something like this. So it's either in...
So I think the $30 fee is to cover the authentication or authoritative statement associated with the records, not just the fact that we're checking our database on the computer or something like that.
Right. I like that, authoritative statement. I'm including that too.
So, I mean, I look at that and see it's justified because every other agency that issues a document that somebody can actually stand on does the same thing.
Right. And I know Ron and I had talked about this repeatedly over the course of time we've worked together, and he was of the old school that believed, well, all of this should be covered in the costs that applicants and registrants pay to apply and renew. And that was fine in the old days when we didn't get all that many requests, but now we have to put a statement on our website that says, we got your request for verification. It might take as much as 30 days for us to get to this, to verify it for you and produce the document you need. So we get so many. It's crazy. And then even more recently, because NCWS messed up their computer system and lost all kinds of documentation or didn't input a lot of documentation from their certificate holders, so they've been sending in requests. Can you verify blah, 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 took our test 20 years ago? It infuriates me because I think they should be keeping their own test records. But, you know, every now and then, like, we get ones from CLARB saying so-and-so certificate's going to expire. Will you please verify that, you know?
But my point is this. They're not going to go to the computer system and just look at the computer and print out a web page that says, oh, yeah, so-and-so is licensed here. I think that the working part of this is that they're getting the certification, that the document is, I don't know if admissible in court is the right term there, but
right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's authoritative. It is. We're absolutely certifying that these are accurate, true, and there's no questioning about this. Please make an authoritative decision on this.
Yeah, that's it. And the laminated pocket card fee just below it is new. That would be something in addition, like if you wanted a laminated card, we're sending you, hopefully, when you renew, you get a PDF that looks right. Like a card that you can print out and laminate yourself. But if you want us to do it, then we're saying that's fine, but we're going to ask that you pay us $10 for that. Again, it's not a required one,
right.
But if you want it, that's what we're going to charge you.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I don't have a problem with that.
Okay.
That's good.
Cool.
I do have a question, though, on this section of the rules is titled fees. There are other fees that are not listed here.
There are other fees, and we are a lucky agency in that some of our fees are exempt by statute. So because of that, we don't include them in the rule. So like application fees, renewal fees.
What do you mean they're exempt by statute?
Our statute exempts them from being required to be placed in rule.
So we can set those by board action.
Exactly.
And not have to. So we can adjust them at will, basically.
Thank you.
Which we have done.
Gives us a lot more flexibility.
And we're very lucky because many of our sister boards and commissions have to put every fee in rule, and they're getting seriously scrutinized by the governor. These are the only fees that we need to put in rule so far. We'll see if our statute remains unscathed.
Later on, we talk, there is a reference to a delinquency fee.
That's also provided for in statute. Yes, it's like one third of something. There's like a calculation, a math calculation. You know how great I am with math. It's included in the statute. It's a percentage of your renewal that you have to pay if you're delinquent.
Okay. All right, that's fine.
Cool. All right. I don't think we only added the alarm business certifications and the alarm controlling persons language to our expiration dates because they're new to us. Complaint review process, you can see what we did. I had a note here to add the EAC language to this statute. So enforcement advisory committees, and then I shortened it with the EAC. Each committee may be comprised of one public member because sometimes it's difficult to get a public member to attend. And as long as we have a quorum, I think that should be sufficient and not stop the board from doing its investigative work. So hopefully with the additions, it makes sense to you. We're talking more about the EAC in Rule 120. We're talking more about the assessment initially in 121. I don't know how that happened way back in the olden days because they really should be reversed. Yeah. But I think as long as we have them separately explained in rule, we're fine.
I just had one comment on the English in C under review process. Respondents are not required to participate in the enforcement advisory committee.
Or
it's really a meeting, right? It's not that they're not on the committee.
True. So how about if I add meeting?
Yeah.
Okay.
Good.
And then I would put it under D as well. C and D probably say meeting.
Right. Yeah.
Good catch. Thank you. Are you okay with the language?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yes.
And now when I was looking at it, I'm like, why are we describing 120 complaint review when it should be, they should be reversed,
yeah.
121 and 120.
Melissa, if you went up to 120A, would it be okay to put language in that said, after doing R-40-30-121, then the board shall select a pool of volunteers, da-da-da-da-da-da-da.
I don't know if we should tie our hands.
Yeah, I don't know if that's necessary, Jason.
Okay.
You know, this is something we could bring up with the Governor's Regulatory Review Council. But these rules have been looked at in theory just a few years ago when we went through our five-year rule review and no one really caught it as being funky except for us.
Well, and I'm not sure that just moving 121 ahead of 120 is really the solution. It's almost like they need to be morphed into one paragraph. Because they're talking, it's all about investigations and resolution of investigations.
I think we're okay.
So I think I would just,
proceed.
Yeah.
With it as
it is.
Okay. And then we wanted it to be clear that we're going to give the information to the respondents so they'll have a fair opportunity to defend, which
I think that's really good.
I don't think anyone will object to that.
No.
And then you'll see we made minor changes to 123. More or less just to sort of update the language of our procedures these days.
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully it makes it a little more clear. Are we ready to go to Article 2, or do you have more comments?
I'm good with moving on.
I'm under 123B. And this is old language, but now that I read it, maybe I'm not reading it correctly, but it says, at any time after formal disciplinary proceedings have been instituted against the registrant may submit to the board an offer of settlement, whereby, and this is the part I'm struggling with, in lieu of formal disciplinary action by the board, the registrant agrees to accept certain sanctions. And yet, as you can read through this, then it says, if the board determines that the proposed settlement will adequately protect the public welfare, the board shall accept the offer and enter a decision consented to by the registrant incorporating the proposed settlement. So it almost sounds like it's that one part of it almost says that it's not formal disciplinary action. Yet it would be. We don't want to do that. We still want to have, them basically come to us and say, boy, I really messed up. You know, I'm willing to take a penalty and you end up still negotiating a consent agreement, and it's still disciplinary action.
How about if we, instead of saying in lieu of formal disciplinary action, we say in lieu of formal hearing? Because that's really...
Yeah,
that's what, mm-hmm.
that's yeah. what it is. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, yeah, and if they agree to a consent order, they basically waive rights to a hearing.
Right,
anyway.
And we will be imposing discipline. It just won't result
yeah.
from the hearing process.
It'll be something that's negotiated.
Right.
When I saw in lieu of formal disciplinary action, that raised the flag.
Yeah, I agree, Ed. Thank
we
you.
We have a lot of people who would have gone,
no formal disciplinary
action.
I'll
fall on my sword. And then they walk away without anything on their record, technically.
Okay, I'll make that, and just in lieu of formal hearing, the registrant agrees to.
Yeah.
Well, should that be an option, though? I mean,
well, it's actually done frequently. I mean, we have folks that will come in and say, yeah, I messed up, and they sit down with enforcement staff, and enforcement staff says, well, you know, based on the severity of your violation, here's a proposed consent agreement, and they might negotiate it, and the person goes, yeah, I'll accept that, and they sign off on it, just bring it to the board, and the board says, yeah, we're good with it, and we vote to accept that consent agreement. So we're kind of doing this process, but it's disciplinary action.
It is. It's true.
Melissa, after Ed's the place where Ed was concerned, there's some examples of what could happen. And at the end of that sentence, it says, or other sanctions. Would it benefit us to put the word in there, or other disciplinary sanctions?
Sure.
Yeah, that's good. Don't sound like you have a question. I apologize, I kind of talked over you.
Well, now that you've raised this and I'm looking at this again, I guess this says upon this the first sentence under A says upon notification of the recommendation of the enforcement committee. So this is after there's been an investigation and after there's been an EAC formed. And
right.
So I think that's what I think would be beneficial for the board, though, is to have the ability to review a complaint and not act on it, so it's not a disciplinary
mm-hmm.
proceeding,
mm-hmm.
right? That already exists.
Correct.
And I'm just, I guess this doesn't this second item, second B, doesn't really hinder the board's ability to make that decision early,
right,
and not initiate a formal proceeding.
Yeah, we always have the option to reject a consent agreement, to dismiss the case if we feel like that's more appropriate. So,
reject a consent agreement. I mean,
not
by the time you get to that point, right?
Yeah, I'm very good.
If you reject a consent agreement, you're basically saying
well, we may feel the penalty's not severe enough, and we'll reject it and send it back, because they always have, the respondent always has the option of going of going to a formal hearing. Mm-hmm. If we let's say that staff negotiate a consent agreement and it's $100 civil penalty, and we think it ought to be $1,000, we'll reject the consent agreement, we'll send it back and say we want the civil penalty to be $1,000. The respondent may go, whoa, that, you know, I do not agree with that. I think that's way over, you know, the severity of this violation, and they won't sign the consent agreement. In 30 days, it gets referred to formal hearing. So, I mean, there's always an escape for either side of the, either party.
Well, and also...
Why is this called informal compliance procedures as opposed to compliance procedures?
Because historically, legally, in administrative proceedings, there's a distinction between informal settlement and formal hearing. So using the word informal kind of goes with a settlement versus proceeding to formal hearing. It's just their terms of art in administrative law.
This involves negotiations. The respondent can basically negotiate, if you will, with board staff on a consent order or an order of discipline. Mm-hmm. Once it goes into formal compliance procedures, it's before this board and there's no negotiating. We will hear the testimony from both sides and we'll render a decision, and it's basically final from our perspective.
Yeah, and what Section B I think allows for as well is a settlement that the Attorney General may reach with the respondent as the hearing approaches. We have looked at those on occasion. Mm-hmm. So, and any settlement is considered an informal resolution versus the proceeding at OR or before the board where a hearing is held.
We've stricken the language, you're either before or after in B.
Right. Well, I guess we don't have to strike it. I don't remember why we took it out.
Well, the paragraph is called informal compliance procedures, and then B says, if we leave it as stricken, B says after formal disciplinary proceedings.
Have been started.
Yeah, maybe leave that in. The after formal disciplinary proceedings is kind of that courthouse steps negotiation.
Yeah. Do you want to just leave the words in? Either before or after?
Yeah, let's leave it in.
Okay. Any other thoughts?
Okay. Move on to page 8.
Yep.
Service date. So Article 2.
Yes.
Some of this is housekeeping from last legislative session.
Yes. And you'll see throughout this document that the phrase in training has been replaced with fundamentals, because the exams aren't referred to as in training exams anymore. So that's, you're going to see starting throughout this whole section. And we added in the language saying an applicant for geology registration can take the fundamentals on the same day as the principles and practices, because they're each only 4-hour exams. And then Section D talks a little bit more about what we've developed at the board with regard to the application committees that have started both for engineering and architecture. So yeah, D is a little bit of a departure just based on what we're doing now with regard to the applications. And it makes more sense anyway, because even if board members are to review the applications, it's really an evaluation that a board member does, not by committee. So. You good with that, Jason?
Yeah, I'm just triple reading it here.
It's a brain drain, isn't it? Rules are hard. Trying to see the big picture and anticipate unexpected consequences, you know.
Well, I've come to kind of realize that you'll never make them perfect. If you can catch 90% of it, that's probably good.
I'm looking back up under paragraph A, specifically subparagraphs 11, 12, and 14, and it seems like those are some redundant. Well, the 11 maybe not, but 12 and 14. We talk about names and addresses of immediate supervisors in past and present employment in the category for which registration was sought. And then 14 says certificate of experience report from the applicant's present and past immediate supervisors. Seems like those are both dealing with the same.
Well, but thing. Then consider it as you're looking at the application form. Our application form requires the applicant in paragraph 12 to put down the name of immediate supervisors, right. Not all of whom may submit certificates of experience
the
for them.
Okay.
Right, because yeah. With the COEs they only need three.
Right.
But they may have more than that as
supervisors. Okay.
And if we ask them to submit all their names, I mean, technically, we could, as board staff, go and talk to other people who we haven't received COEs from. So right. I think that okay. may have been why it was drafted that way okay. initially.
I don't know if it's I thought I'd made a note, but I don't see it. About it seems to imply that all former employers. And maybe somewhere else in here I had a similar comment about how far back, you know, does an applicant have to go?
Yeah, I think the rule 10 years is what
10 years is what shows
rule.
Under 12.
Do you think that's too long a time?
Not really.
No?
No.
Happy medium. Maybe okay. a little on the long side, but not that
yeah.
long.
Okay.
Well, at
for
11...
Those of us that have been around long enough.
Yeah.
Going to Ed's comments, 11 says name, address, telephone number, current and former employers in the category. And then 12
talks about
supervisors
right.
employment for 10 years. Is it just seems like
it's kind of muddy.
It's, yeah, it's not clear that.
And I think.
I mean, maybe the 10 years should be in both if we're going to do that. Maybe it should be in both. 11
yeah,
and 12.
We could be
11.
Consistent. I think that's why we put company names in the parentheses to distinguish 11 from 12, whereas 11's asking what company did you work for? 12's asking who were your immediate supervisors? But, I mean, we can take a stab at making it clearer.
Well, I don't see that it's necessary to go back more than 10 years for
okay.
employers and it just make it clearer. To the applicant is what's being required, what is required.
you want to add any clarifying language, or you think what we have up there is sufficient?
Well, I would suggest putting the 10 years in 11, yeah. I guess.
Put most recent 10-year period.
Yeah.
In 11, right?
Yeah.
Okay. And subsection C, I think it's really important, rather than calling them national registration bodies, we refer to them as national examination councils, which is what they really are. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I know NCWS would love to be a national registration body, but it isn't.
None of them are.
Yeah.
And that leads to misperceptions on our governance side.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
D looks good.
Are we ready to go to 202 in training? Now, in reality, we are only issuing in training designations to 3 of our big 5. We no longer issue in training designations for architects or landscape architects. So only geologists, engineers, and surveyors will apply and do apply for in training designation in Arizona now. So it made it easy when we substituted the phrase in training with the word fundamentals, because each of the 3 that are currently applying for in training have to take a fundamentals exam.
So if they pass the fundamentals exam, they're becoming an in training.
They certainly qualify for the designation. Some don't apply for it.
You have to apply for it after you take it?
Yeah, because we don't always get exam scores, or someone took the fundamentals in Massachusetts and then wants to apply for in training in Arizona. They apply for the in training designation. They have to provide proof they've passed the fundamentals exam. I know it's
why bother?
Well, I don't know. Maybe it's a requirement of employment or whatever. Or they take the fundamentals because Arizona has authorized it, and then they want to get registered in California, so we don't automatically issue an in-training unless they want it.
And my guess is it allows them to use the word engineer on a card, because it's got an official state sanction on it, whereas what do they call themselves? It's like the architects in training.
Mm-hmm.
We call them interns.
Right.
In spite of what NCARB says.
They're
interns. None of my people seem to have a problem with that.
You know, I think that's... yeah. So you'll see in Category C, we talk about the board shall permit an applicant for engineer in training to take the fundamentals exam in the final year of their schooling. And that, from what I understand in researching this, is an agreement that we inherited from NCWS. NCWS is making these agreements with certain schools that ask if they can, I don't know if they buy the exam from NCWS, but NCWS is actually providing the fundamentals exam to engineering students in the last year of their schooling. And not all schools do it. But, like, for instance, I think ASU and U of A are doing it, but not NAU.
I think My perception was it's a condition of graduation.
For yes. some of them,
but I think
yeah.
they just sign up. I think what NCWS has allowed is early entry to it, but I don't think they've actually acquired the exam. I think
okay.
they still go
to the exam center.
Right.
To the
exam
but they have the exam centers right there on the school campus.
Right.
Yeah, they're right there on campus.
But for instance, the ASVOG exam is not available to the geology students at NAU in the last year. They actually have to graduate before they qualify through the ASVOG requirement to sit for the fundamentals of geology. So that's why we put in engineering training up here, because it's, I don't believe any of the surveying programs have the same accessibility.
But what if NAU change their policy, or ASVOG change their policy? To me, part of this rewrite, this tweaking, is to make it flexible. And so we want to limit it just to engineers. I mean, things could change.
Interestingly enough, we had the exact question from several geology students at NAU. They quoted us this section of the rule and said, well, it says any applicant for in training designation. And we had to say, but ASVOG, if you look at the rules later on about geologists, they require graduation before they will let you sit for the exam. So it's in another rule, the geologist in training rule, that requires graduation. So we thought, let's make it specific here. I mean, it's funny because it took 7 or 8 years for me to see a geologist student use this section and say, I want to take the test early. And we had to say, ASVOG won't let you.
Well, quite honestly, architects can't take it early. But I think we need to be looking ahead.
Yeah.
Because as the APL, alternative path to licensure, becomes more and more realistic and more accepted, these students are going to be taking some parts of the exam
earlier
with their degree. Yeah.
Except that architects aren't getting training designation.
We're not getting right. No, I'm just saying. I just want that in my head so that as we go through this, just to make sure we're not narrowing the door for
other future
programs and applicants.
Well. We don't have to do it if you don't like it.
No, I think this is fine on the engineering side. I want to make sure we're just not making it so narrow. I mean, so it maybe there's a way to word it that says unless otherwise restricted by the examination provider, or that's not the right wording. But you see where I'm going.
But that opens you up for the ninth floor to say you're restricting.
Yeah.
What if somebody has a few years of experience working under a registered geologist, and then they go to NAU? Does that preclude them from taking the fundamentals before they graduate?
Sounds like it.
Yeah.
You need a bachelor's degree to take it.
Early, though. That's what this is talking about. In the final year, I mean, they may be able to apply to us, and they do sometimes apply to us without any schooling.
Mm-hmm.
This section just doesn't apply to them.
Right.
Okay.
You know, we give them the authority based on what education they might have and whatever experience they have, but we're looking at 48 months at that point.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas here, this will be more like 45 months. You know, if they've just been to school and they have no experience. So, yeah, we are holding them to a different standard, technically, but we're not precluding them from getting access to the exam if they don't have an education. Bill's looking at me with a curious look.
Well, I don't see a problem with taking the exam in the final year of school, you know, or taking it before you graduate, taking the fundamentals exam. Because basically, it tests you on the things you learned in school,
mm-hmm.
right?
And if ASVOG has a policy where you know they don't allow you to do that, that's fine, but that could change, as Ed says. You know, I could make that change.
It's true. So let's think about this when we look at the geologist rules further on, because if we want to make this more inclusive for the possibility of allowing geology candidates and surveying candidates to take it in the last year of school, we're going to have to make the change to the specific geology and training statute, the rule later on in the packet, okay?
Is it our rule right now that
it's our rule
it?
Right
it's
now that,
or is it ASBOG that precludes early entry to the exam?
You know, that's a really good question. I don't have the answer to that.
Quite honestly, what I'd be more comfortable with is if it's our rule that's precluding geologists from early entry, then let's change our rules. If it's ASBOG,
yeah,
we can change our rules all we want. It won't help them any.
Yeah,
no,
see,
but it,
it's
but still
the ASBOG changes it. You know?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Still,
and then it's not on us. And then from a governor's perspective,
we're being less restrictive.
Yeah. It's the exam administering agency that's putting the restriction on
yeah.
the applicant.
Our rule is 242, geologists in training designation. And if you want to skip to that now, to qualify for admission to the fundamentals exam solely based on education, they have to be a graduate of a four-year degree program with a major in geology. Okay.
So we would want to change that to something like be in their final year of
a
four-year degree program.
Shall be
like
a graduate or be in the final year of a four-year degree program.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
What if they flunk? What if they never get a degree? Does that matter?
Well, we'll find out about that, and then we'll just require more experience.
Well, then they need 48 months.
Yeah.
Yeah, so...
Okay.
So if you get a BS, automatically qualifies you as 48 months.
And if they don't get it, then we prorate and give them...
Yeah.
Whatever they have.
36 months of education and 12 months of experience.
Yeah.
Yeah, and Article B under this addresses that.
Okay.
Yeah. So if we make that addition to subsection
yeah.
A of 242, saying that an applicant shall be a graduate or be in the final year of a four-year degree program with a major in geology, We have to make the change then in C of 202. How about if we just strike engineer in training? Just leave it as it is for the in training. Okay. Because that would leave it open for surveying in training as well.
Yes.
Do you think we need to make corresponding changes to subsection B of 242? To qualify for admission to the fundamentals exam, an applicant who is not a graduate of a four-year degree program shall have at least 4 years of education or experience, or both, directly related to the practice of geology. And then we explain all those areas of experience. I don't think so, but what do you think?
I think this gives you your...
criteria for...
Yeah,
geology,
ASBOG won't give you the test, and so therefore...
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Okay.
Go ahead.
While we're on 242, I was wondering about a major in geology as opposed to earth science.
Do you want to add earth science?
Well, I think most of the programs today are called earth science. They're not called geology. You know, you don't typically get a degree in I shouldn't say typically, but because I don't know every university in the country, but it just seems like. There's a trend towards using
earth
the term
science.
Earth science.
Do you want to change it entirely or say geology and...
Well, I think the degree, the major, when it talks about a degree, then I think earth science is appropriate. But when it speaks to experience, I think
geology
is the right term.
Yeah.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
Because you're getting registered as a geologist, not as an earth scientist.
Right.
Or,
yeah,
or a hydrology or something like that. Okay. So I'll add... a major in geology or earth science.
Yeah.
And then do you want to leave it as it is in B, where we're talking about the practice of geology?
Yeah, practice of geology.
Okay.
Yes. Practice. Okay. When it refers to the practice, it'd be practice of geology. I think that's right.
Okay. Yeah. Rather than earth science,
yes,
or hydrology or any,
right,
of that. Okay.
Right. Yeah, let's not get into the hydrology thing.
Okay.
So, on back on subparagraph A, 242A, it says that the four-year degree program, we tweaked that language. It says, at a college or university accredited at the time of graduation by a regional accrediting agency recognized by the Arizona Board of Regents.
I know, that's archaic.
Well, and it doesn't reflect that the geology or earth science degree could be from somewhere else that a board doesn't even know anything about. And all of our other rule language tends to just say a nationally recognized accrediting agency or something like that.
Okay.
Yeah.
To pin it down to the A board.
To say nationally.
If you go up to one of the A board members right now and go, can you tell me who the regional accrediting agency for geology or earth science is? They'd look at you like you were on a trip.
So how about if we say, geology or earth science at a college or university nationally accredited at the time of graduation, period.
Yep.
Accredited by a national...
Accredited by a national accreditation...
Accreditation council or...
Council, national accreditation...
And we have to be careful with the at the time of graduation wording, because... Like, if you look at a lot of, like, NCARB, I don't know how NCWS is about this, but NCARB, let's say I'm in my second to last year of school, and my school loses their accreditation. If I graduate within 2 years of loss of accreditation, I'm still considered to have a NAB-accredited degree.
Right, and we mentioned it, if you look at 222 for engineering training just above, we mention Accreditation Board for Engineering and Technology, ABET, or an equivalent predecessor organization. So we do mention the accrediting body for engineers.
Yeah.
But that's unique to engineering, I think.
True.
Isn't it?
And we probably do
and
the same for architects.
You know
it's
what?
Probably under NAB.
There's no national accrediting body for geology anyway.
Well, do we need to...
We need to create one.
Okay. It could be a moneymaker.
Yeah.
So do we need to take...
How about if we just say accredited at the time of graduation?
But is there anybody accrediting them? Because if nobody's accrediting them, then we have them. Then we're creating an impossible situation.
Yeah, it's true.
Because then we're saying, oh, well, your degree, you're accredited.
There's no accreditation period?
How about if we say at an accredited college or university?
There you go.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because then
that way it's not Trump
U
or fly by night U,
right,
or something.
Yeah.
Accredited college or university.
Yeah, I think that's a good.
Okay, well, let's try that, because I think there's one geology program. Patty was looking into it. I can't remember, somewhere in the South that has an ABET accreditation in geology, but there's just one school that. Yeah.
So
do we want to leave in the language recognized by the Board of Regents?
No, we're
going to strike that. And then if we get pushback from GER, I'll let you guys know.
Well, and I don't know how we will, because it's not parallel to any of the other texts,
right,
or any of the other disciplines.
Right. Okay.
So go back to, where were we?
We were on page 10. And we took out engineer for engineer and training designation, and then we struck remediation specialist.
Yep, that's
done. So we're on to waiver of exam, and this is where last time when we met, we had a whole discussion about this rule and the possibility of creating two rules, but when I went back and looked at it, I couldn't figure out how to do it. So it's back in pretty much the same form it was, but for the fact that I added in parentheses CLARB, NCWS, and CARB, and the usual fixes of fundamentals in place of in training and examination council in place of registration body. So I struck section one and
yes,
left the new section one, inserting the words or U.S. territory.
Good.
So what do you think? Do you still want to make two rules, or do you think the way this looks now is okay?
I think
if you, since you're striking one, do you have a one underneath
that? Yeah,
you
don't need to have a one necessarily.
You don't need to have the one.
Well,
maybe you need a B.
Here's.
Huh?
I think you need a one.
But there's no two.
So. Yeah.
I thought you needed, in order to have a one, you had to have a two. Not, I mean, that's the way the codes all work. That's all.
You know, I'm all in favor of striking one, but it does create a quandary because the new paragraph one, old paragraph two, basically references a registrant who's been practicing for at least 10 years. We don't have anything for that new registrant in New Mexico who now wants to come to Arizona and get licensed, say, 2 years after they're licensed in New Mexico, 1 year, 6 months.
New Mexico and they don't is have a blue cover state.
I know, but let's say, well, no, and that makes it easy, but,
that's for
okay,
them,
so maybe it's Idaho. He's not a blue cover state. And so what do you do with that? How do we evaluate that registrant who probably...
We consider
went through the
them.
Same course of action, but I don't see anything in rule here that helps to address that.
Well,
we had it up above when we were dealing with the substantially identical and all of that, and that, you know, you get an applicant who was licensed in 1975, and how in the heck do I know, well, I kind of do because I know the history of this board pretty well, but, you know, how does somebody, an evaluator, know what the registration requirements for Arizona were in 1975?
But we should,
versus their state.
If the person applies as, I mean, they're going to apply for registration, and with that application comes along the proof they passed the exam and they've completed IDP,
right,
or they've been in practice since 1975, which would meet our current requirements. So,
well, 75 is a little extreme because that falls under the 10-year practice rule, but yeah, let's say it's, yeah, let's say they went, every state but Colorado is an IDP state.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Colorado's not IDP?
They still have an alternative path.
Ooh.
But they have to, basically they have to comply with IDP, it's just their own, they can
their own version.
They don't have to do the record keeping. So yeah, I guess they would just send their application in there
for professional registration rather than for waiver of exam.
Right.
Because they've already taken it.
Well, yeah, it's kind of a, it's still a waiver of exam because we don't have a comity or a reciprocity statute. So it's still waiver of exam, but they'll just apply. I just want to make sure we're not.
I know, I appreciate it.
By eliminating paragraph one, are we suddenly, if you pick up the rule book, that could almost be interpreted as, God, I've got to be practicing in Idaho for 10 years before I can apply in Arizona.
However, looking at the old paragraph one that we struck, staff never knows if back in the day Colorado or whatever state had substantially identical requirements.
None of us do.
Right. So why do we have that in rule anyway? You know what I mean?
So do we... To me, not to oversimplify it, but they were qualified to get licensed in, and this is something that we're hammering home now at NCARB on the credential alternative review team stuff. It's like, people are getting nitpicky when we did our training, and it's like, people, these folks are licensed
right
in another jurisdiction already.
So
they passed the test, they met the experience requirement, whatever it may have been.
Even if back in the day they were not required to test, they're still licensed, and as long as they're in good standing, why should we say they can't practice in Arizona, right?
Uh-huh. Right.
So they would just apply for professional
registration
and show us their verification that they, you know, are in good standing registered in North Dakota or wherever in the hinterland, and we license them.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So
take out the 10 years?
Yeah, that's my
next
point, is maybe we don't need the 10 years. As long as they're verifiably documented, actively engaged as a professional, does it have to be 10 years?
Yeah. I think if we strike one, I would agree we take out 10.
It's really back to the discussion, I can't remember the gentleman that was here from ASU, but talking about, you know, all of the experience realm, you know, in the universities and even NCARB, CWS, everybody, you know, it's becoming more and more outcomes-based rather than seat time. I mean, it's like, are you competent?
Yeah.
You know, there are people that can sit in a chair and have 20 years of experience and not be competent enough to be licensed. And there's people that can do it for 3 years and be more competent than others.
Well, and then if you look at B, where we're saying 5 years, so maybe we take out in subparagraph 1, as long as they're, you know, put a period after, or U.S. territory, take out for at least 10 years, just take out for at least 10 years in the category for which registration is sought. Just take out that for at least 10 years. Then also put a period at the end of that paragraph, and has been practicing or offering professional services.
Get rid of that.
And
I think that cleans it up.
What do you guys agree?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So there's a period after U.S. territory.
U.S. territory.
Just say, it'll say, or licensee in another state or U.S. territory, in the category which registration, certification, or licensure is sought.
Yep. Okay.
So the next sentence really gets struck too. Then.
You don't have to define
actively engaged as a professional registrant. Right?
Yeah, and but I think we do.
I think I would leave that.
Get rid of at least 10 years, or offer professional
services for at least 10 of the last
15 years. Yeah.
Well, I thought we needed that 10 of the past 15 years, because when you're offering, people are coming in and they haven't been practicing for 20 years, but, you know, and all that type of stuff. I thought that's been useful in evaluating.
This is what we've used for those sneaky foreign apps. You know, the foreign applicants who don't want to test, don't want to take the ARE specifically.
Yeah.
Well, if you can show that you've been actively practicing in Guatemala or wherever for 10 of the last 15 years, then you can waive. But here, we're basically eliminating that by saying you have to be a professional in the U.S.
or U.S. territory.
Or U.S. territory, and anyone else would have to test.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
So then going down to B, do we want to remove 5 years?
So this takes out the foreign registration altogether.
Yep, they have to take.
I'm all for that.
I am too. I have talked about this.
Yeah.
It's like,
I think that was a loophole that people were trying to drive Mack trucks through.
Yep, they were.
Mm-hmm.
and they're so hard to evaluate.
And when Ron was here, he was letting them. He was encouraging it. And everybody was like, no.
Well, I don't know why we need the 5 years, I guess, here either.
Yeah.
I mean, if we don't have a number of years in the...
Yeah, B just says if you have a certificate from these three national councils, you kind of automatically qualify for registration.
Well, it says and is registered in good standing.
Right.
So,
Not only do you have to have a certificate,
and quite honestly, let's look at this. I know the part of the 5-year deal was to try to keep people current with, make sure they're still practicing and things like that. We have no way of knowing.
Can she also come on the thing?
Oh, yeah, I'll try.
Okay.
So,
I think, honestly, what this addresses is the engineers who get registered in California, where they can get registered 2 years earlier than they can here.
They get registered after 3. We don't get registered till 4.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Or 6 years instead of 8.
Yeah. Well, after,
Yeah, so 60 months instead of...
And we're about...
Michelle?
We're about to face that with...
Barry,
you're right.
We are going to face
I'll put you on hold this so I can connect you with Jason at the same time. Okay.
We'll
deal with that a little further down.
Do you want to take out within the 5 years?
I think so, because back to what I was going to use as an example is people we regulate... I mean, I could quit practicing architecture tomorrow, keep my registration current in this state,
Jason,
go work at a casino for 10 years, and as long as I kept my license current, I could re-enter the practice of architecture 10 years from now, and no one at this board would be the wiser.
No one would be the wiser,
Yeah, I've kept my registration active.
Mm-hmm.
So...
Well, for that matter, you could keep it active, go to work, not push a pencil or a number for 10 years, and then go back in and try to start designing again.
Yeah.
Which is completely...
Scary.
Yeah.
but it could happen, and there's no way to monitor that.
That's right.
You're in good standing.
I mean, we do have, in statute now, the authority to require retesting if you've been expired or canceled for 5 years.
Yeah, and that's fine.
But... If you keep your membership up or you keep paying your license,
I've been licensed in Oregon for 12 years. I haven't practiced in Oregon for 10.
Yeah, but you've been an actively practicing registrant in other states.
Right, no, and I'm just saying, as far as Oregon's concerned, I'm still a practicing architect in Oregon.
Right.
I haven't done anything.
But you guys remember that architect applicant, Mr. Valentine, who stopped practicing 15 years ago and then wanted to get a waiver of the exam, and we're like, sorry, you don't have any current registrations anywhere. Right. We need to know you're safe to practice. You have to test. So, let's take out that phrase within the 5 years immediately preceding the date of application.
I'd like to say that Michelle Guy is now with us as well as Jason on the phone.
Welcome, Michelle.
Good morning, Michelle.
Thank you. Sorry for being late. I apologize, everyone. And I'm going to be one of those people that's going to be, has been inactive for more than 5 years and will need to retest to get current on my RLS again, so.
Okay, then.
All right.
And we're on page 11 of that Word document I sent to Michelle.
Okay, thank you.
I think
we're about ready to move on to
page
12.
So in 204, we're talking about issuing authorizations to test, not determining exam equivalency, which is why we are calling it what it really is.
Okay. That's good.
And... you'll see subsection 14 is what Ed and I worked on.
Yeah.
And after I put it in like that, Ed, I think we need to describe what the six practice areas
I think require. We need to describe those, and then I would like to suggest, and I've worked them up, except one of them went away.
Before we get to that, can I go back to A, under 204A?
Sure.
And this goes back to the earlier section where we talked about the number of employers or the length of time. Do we need to put 10 years in here or something? We're talking about, we're asking the applicant to provide the applicant's current and former employers. Do we need to
which
put
seven paragraphs?
Good catch.
Is that?
Yes.
This is 7A.
So.
Yeah.
Section 8 and 10, you think?
Yes.
And then also under 6, certified transcripts from the registrar of each college, university, or educational institution attended, and I'm wondering if. All we're really interested in is the relevant education, not just, I mean, if somebody went to school to be a historian, you know, for we don't need their transcripts, right?
Actually, we do.
Or we do.
Yes, because at least for an architect candidate, I could grant up to close to 12 months of experience for just under the Gen Ed category, according to the NAB accreditation standard, which is what I kind of use as a guideline. I could grant up to 12 months of experience for somebody with a bachelor's in history. A lot of that Gen Ed is in there that would be reasonably equivalent to the NAB Gen Ed requirements. And so I like to see those transcripts. And even a high school transcript is important because you want to make sure they have a high school degree, because that's part of our, you know, if they've done the work experience or the experience route for the entire. We need to make sure that they're documenting that properly.
So it just seems college, university, I can understand, or educational institution, I guess it's awfully broad. Maybe it's not an issue. Maybe it's not a concern. It just seems like it's an awfully broad statement to me.
Well, educational institution, interestingly enough, Jason knows this, they're starting to create... like for the surveyor, what is Kent calling them, Jason? There's like that special surveyor apprenticeship program that Kent and...
Yeah, I looked at that. It's a program that he's running through or is being run through construction technology at one of the schools in Phoenix. And... looks like a good program. It's something that if I was evaluating, I'd look at each class and I could see where there might be an opportunity for somebody that's using this form of education to claim some time piecemeal through these classes rather than saying a complete degree or stating that they have a complete degree from somewhere.
But it's like equivalent to the Gen Ed... credits that Ed might award. Mm-hmm. So I like weaving educational institution in there.
It gives us flexibility.
Yeah. But I take your point to heart, Bill, about making this rule look more like 201, where we're talking about registration application requirements. You know, in the most recent 10-year period, putting in the company names for employers and additional professional references so that this rule looks more like what we have earlier on, like certificate of experience. So if you guys are okay with that, I will make those changes to conform with the previous rule. Are we good?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, I think so. Um, So back down to... Paragraph 14. That's the ARE.
Yes, so I need some more...
So I think...
we need more meat to the definitions of practice management, project management.
Yeah, and there are... There are little summaries on the AXP guidelines. Like, and okay. We can tweak the wording, but I can email you the file. It's not too big.
Okay.
Like project development and documentation, this is how it's worded, we'll just tweak it. In project development and documentation, you'll gain experience with projects after the schematic design has been approved, focusing on construction documents and coordinating with regulatory authorities to gain necessary approvals for construction.
Okay.
So that's just brief thing.
Yeah.
We can plug those in. What I would like to suggest, because it would help us in evaluating the applications, because part of what I look for is diversity of experience in that, even in that 5-year time frame. So I don't really want to see somebody that's falling under project development documentation and nothing else in that 5-year, because that to me is not the equivalent of the educational process, which is going to touch on all of these areas. And because it's kind of a dynamic evaluation, it could be we're evaluating 5 years of experience for somebody with a high school diploma. We could be evaluating 1 or 2 years depending upon the degree they have. If they have a 4-year architecture degree, I'm only evaluating 1 year, but I would still like to see a good cross-section of diversity. So I came up with, I went into the AXP and looked at the minimum hours in each of the 6 categories against the total hours and developed percentages.
Oh, you want to put actual percentages?
I'm thinking, can we put percentages in there? I don't know what you think of that.
I think that's kind of restrictive. That's my first influence there. I mean, I agree with what you're saying, and I propose up here where we say the board, they must provide the board with 60 months or 5 years of a diversity of experience mm-hmm. directly related.
Okay.
But maybe not be quite so specific with a percentage.
Hmm. Yeah, you'd have to calculate it for every applicant. You know,
We won't always be lucky to have Ed Marley on the board.
Only another year and a half.
The only thing that I would say is, as an ALA, you're going to be able to, at least the ALA, are we talking about that?
No, we're still talking about the ARE, the architects.
Okay, the architects, okay. Have nothing to say on that stuff.
I'm okay just leaving it as it is and then putting the description, and maybe we tweak the wording above so that...
we just include that generic diversity of experience.
Yeah, make sure that diversity of experience is included in there and say show experience in each of the following categories or something like mm-hmm. that.
Yes.
That way they know they got to touch on it.
Yep. In order to obtain board authorization to sit for the required registration exam. Okay.
Just editorial, do we need 60 months or 5 years?
Nope,
is it the same thing?
We can have one or the other. Which do you prefer, the months or the years? Probably the months, because NCARB does months, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. Okay.
That way you don't have to have a 4.4.
Yeah.
So you'll send me the language you quoted, which sounded good.
Yeah.
Thank you, sir.
Yeah. What I might do is just copy and paste those into an email for each one, and then spare you having to wade through the whole document.
Thank you, sir. Other comments on page 12?
Yes. Under C2. Where it says applicants not possessing degrees may apply to the board for examination, and after board review may be recommended. Is this recommended by the board to the applicable national
mm-hmm.
council?
Mm-hmm.
So maybe we should just make it clear who's doing the recommendation by the recommended by the board.
Right? Okay.
Okay.
For examination approval, after which the board, and after board review, the board may. Other comments or concerns? It's so funny because you can see, like, we refer to them as national councils here, but we had referred to them as national registration bodies before.
Yeah.
And so at various times we're not consistent in the rules.
Page 12? Or page 13, I'm sorry, 13. So, now that we've added paragraph 6, which covers multi-division national exams, I'm looking at paragraph 3, where it says, must take and pass the examination. And I'm thinking specifically the ARE, we refer to it as, that's the exam.
Mm-hmm.
And
well, the ARE and the LARE and the SE are the only multi-divisional
right.
exams. Like, if someone just applies to take the principles of geology or another PE, it's not multi-divisional.
Right.
So they have to do that.
Yeah. No, I don't disagree with you. I'm just concerned about the wording of the examination.
Okay.
'Cause the ARE is the examination. It happens to be a multi-division examination.
So do you have a problem with the wording of 6 or a problem with...
Well, in 6 I want to discuss other issues I have. I'm just worried, is there a conflict there between 3 and 6?
And pass the examination.
Right.
In other words, to me, that could be interpreted, well, is it a section or is it, I got to pass all 5 divisions of the ARE.
Yeah.
I guess we could say a non-multi-divisional exam because
professional, a professional non-multi-divisional
exam in any
examination.
Category.
Well, we're calling it an application for a professional exam taken past the for a non. How about if we say an applicant for a non-multi-divisional?
But then that doesn't make somebody an ARE applicant, an ARE candidate, doesn't make them take and pass at least one of the sections of the exam within that year time period.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we want to say something about must take and pass division of an examination because. If it, uh-huh. Some of them are only one division exams. If you're going for a PE civil, it's a one division exam.
Yeah.
If you're going for an ARE, it's a 5 division exam. If you're going for an SE, it's two.
Two or four.
Yeah.
I think it's two.
It's two. Right. Okay, so if we make it say
four.
An applicant An applicant for professional exam in any category must take and pass the examination or at least one division of a multi-divisional exam within 1 year after receiving approval.
Mm-hmm. Got a rainy Tuesday.
Sure. Yeah. Yes. And then does that jive, in your opinion, with six that will close the examination file if they fail to pass all divisions within 5 years? I think it does. Mm-hmm.
It does. Yeah. I struggle with that because NCARB has a 5-year rolling clock. NCARB, you can keep taking the exam. You just, your exams fall off and you have to retake those exams that are older than 5 years.
What's nice is reading on the structural. I don't know if it's 5 years or not.
Yeah, NCWS gives them 5 years.
5 years to pass the same.
Yep. Seems like an awfully long time to me.
I'm struggling with this because somebody who took an exam a year ago but took their first exam 6 years ago, suddenly are we telling them they have to start over or they just have to reapply?
They have to reapply.
And then I just want to make it clear that they have to reapply but they don't lose.
You architects make everything so complicated.
We're just a pain in the neck, aren't we?
Well, that's not the word I was going to use.
No. Well, we're being recorded. So, we're, you know.
Well, but we're also saying unless we approve an extension in six.
Then you have an out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
So if they come and they whine and they say, okay, I took and passed my first division and then, I don't know, whatever happened
life
to
happened.
Them. Right. And I should get to...
You're dealing with more millennials now, so...
Yeah.
I mean, I don't want to be flip about it, though, because you do have a point that...
Emerald's over.
NCARB allows them to keep taking, but they just have to retake.
Well, how about if we say the board may close instead of the board shall close? I don't know if that helps, probably not, but...
Leave the shall and leave the extension in.
Yeah, I think
okay.
It's fine.
Okay. I mean, the intent would be to have them update their application, tell us what happened within that 5-year period of time, and because lots of things change, not only just addresses, but citizenship status can change, employment, obviously, the board needs that.
And maybe there's a way down the road to streamline that reapplication process so that all they have to do is just show that they're currently employed. Or, you know what I mean? I hate for them to have to keep bringing back COEs or... all of these will have IDP council records.
Right,
so
and
really
we're going
to
have a new computer system that will allow us to access previous file information.
So then, because they technically would have gone through IDP now to take the ARE and the license, then they can,
I like six.
Okay.
I'm a mean regulator.
You are.
Well, it's easier, I mean...
It's fine. I think, let's just leave it.
I think it falls under the loophole status. If you give somebody a little tiny place to put a wedge, they'll start hammering all sorts of stuff through it.
Well, and you know what, guys? This is still the beginning of this whole rules process. You know, once you're done with this review, we can put this draft with your recommended edits on the board agenda, and then if the board's okay with it, I still have to write a... please let us make these changes to our rules letter to the governor before we get an approval to enter into the regulatory review council process where the public will have an opportunity to say this is too harsh or maybe we want to make changes there, you know.
Has the public ever responded?
They do, actually. I think when we did our 5-year rules review, we had two comments, not many, but at other agencies, it can be pretty hotly contested. One of the things I'm kind of proud of us for doing is including stakeholder organizations in this process at this early level. So hopefully we address any concerns they might have before it all starts. So
it's a lot easier to do it then.
Yeah.
After you're in the middle.
Yeah. Well, because, I mean, it's still good when, you know, you're in the GRRC process. You just need to report on who commented, what did they say, and then what did the board do about it, you know. But it's easier now, more informal.
Paragraph D1. I had a question on that. I'm fine with the must take and pass the examination within 1 year from making a request to test. I'd like to suggest we just get rid of the next sentence. The applicant shall communicate all questions and concerns regarding extension, special accommodations, and refunds to the board.
Because
I think it's covered under the next sentence. First of all, I don't think we generally don't give refunds.
I like that, Ed. Thank you.
And the next sentence talks about special exam accommodation or additional time.
Mm-hmm.
So
people can be specific in their actual request to the board about what they need. I like that. Thank you.
I wondered if we needed, at the end of the first sentence, unless granted an extension, like in the previous section.
Yeah, that's good.
Okay.
I mean, there can be circumstances where illness or something like that, and when you get 1 year, you're talking about 12 months exactly, not 13 months or 12 and a half months.
Right.
So I think there should be some flexibility.
Yeah.
And that makes sense because it's more than just the state-specific surveying exam. We do get an occasional geological engineering exam request, so that's a PE. Did you take that? No.
I wrote it.
You wrote it?
Well, parts of it.
Okay, then. Cool.
I took it after I wrote it. It was pretty easy.
But some of the questions were ambiguous.
Yeah.
No, we had it psychometrically vetted in 2014.
Yeah. Yeah.
Cool.
And then on just to go on to this, are we through with one?
Yeah.
On two, it looks like the addition of and pass was maybe one of these global changes or something, but the applicant's desire to retake, they obviously have a desire to pass it, but right. I mean, shouldn't we just say retake and strike and pass?
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Dear board, I desire to retake and pass the exam. Please.
It was just Melissa getting
sure
carried
that
away with trying to yeah.
I applied for a pass.
Actually, what you should remove is the take and just put pass because they could take it and not pass it and still moving, right?
Yeah, but we're talking about written confirmation of their intent to sit again. So they can sit again, but they may not pass. So
right.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah. And then we eliminated 5 and 6 from D because we thought 6, we thought 5 actually is addressed in number 6, C6 above. So hopefully it makes sense.
Okay.
And
208.
This was a result of the cleanup we talked about at the last meeting.
And what I'd like to do under 1B, architectural applicants, I would like to say with a 4-year architectural degree. Because that implies that there are other accredited degrees out there.
Okay.
And so if we just say a 4-year architectural degree, that can be That could be like a degree from ASU, or you've got a B.Arch or a Bachelor of Arts in Architecture or a Bachelor of Science in Architecture, both of which are predecessors to a NAV-accredited master's program, so they would get 48 months of credit.
So if we take out NAV, we're...
Just say four-year architectural degree.
Degree, okay.
And take out NAV and accredit it, yeah.
Okay. And the bigger change, I think, was... Then we made similar changes with landscape architect degree. Leroy, are you happy with the way that's worded? With a landscape architectural degree... I don't know if we need accrediting board language. What do you think? Landscape architectural applicants with an accredited landscape architectural degree, or should we say lab? Keep lab?
Unless you're going to accept somebody else's accreditation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I like it with just the lab.
Yeah.
You like it with just lab?
Yeah.
Okay.
No, it doesn't matter if they're Masters of Arts or Masters of Science in any of these.
Do we
don't care.
If they have a Master's in Architecture and it's NAV accredited, it automatically rolls up under A for architects.
Well, I'm just running into this with my kids the last couple of years. If I take the extra science, I get a Bachelor's or Master's of Science, but if I don't take that, I get a Master's of Arts, and so, do we want that more science or not?
I'll defer to the engineering side of that.
Yeah. So
engineering,
the RC architects would go with the Master of Arts or Bachelor of Arts.
So are there any other possibilities, I guess, is my question. We have, for architects, we have the five-year NAV-accredited degree gets in 60 months. The four-year architectural degree gets them 48 months. For landscape architects, the landscape architectural applicants with a landscape architectural accrediting board accredited degree, lab, gets them 48 months, right, Leroy?
Mm-hmm. Which it looks like you might have
struck
through that.
It looks like I struck, but I meant 48 months, and then they get 60 months if they have a lab-accredited master's degree.
Right.
Am I missing anything else in those two, architecture or landscape architecture?
I suppose if you want to, you can... Oh, no, because we just say with a NAV-accredited degree, so we cover the whole spectrum. We cover a five-year or a master's. A five-year B.Arch or a master's under A were covered.
They're going to get 60
We took out the five-year.
Okay.
We took out, so it's just architecture applicants with NAV-accredited degree, 60 months. We're covered.
Right, so it's either a master's or a five-year. Okay.
Yeah.
So then, can we look at the engineers? Is that, we're good with that? Engineering apps with ABET gets 60 months?
60 months for a master's, 48 for a bachelor. Yeah.
Okay, we don't touch on master's in the engineering. We probably have a, or do we? Yes, we do. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
There it is. I'm sorry.
I'm wondering if it should be master's degree or advanced degree. Because
this is master's, class,
or doctorate.
Doctorate.
Where does it say that? Sorry.
It says ABET master's or doctorate degree or branch of engineering.
But for the other disciplines, it only says master's. And I'm wondering if the...
Some
people don't get a master's, they just get a doctorate. You know?
True.
Mm-hmm.
But for the engineers, we're saying that doctorate degree has to be in the branch of engineering that they want to be registered in. So they could be a PhD in civil, but they want to be a mechanical. They're not going to get 60 months.
Yeah.
Right? They'll get 48, because then F says engineering apps with ABET accredited bachelor's degree or equivalent in the same branch gets 48 months, and then four-year accredited degree in a branch other than which get 36.
Right.
We're good with that?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's the way it's been for a long time, so.
Geology, should we say in earth geology sciences? Or earth sciences?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I had that comment.
Earth science.
And same thing under J then.
Yeah.
We're but done with assayers.
We are. And remediation specialists.
Hi. Say something. Certainly. Which letter are you on now?
We're on R43208A1. This is page 13.
Aye.
And the only surveyor degree we account for, Jason, is surveying applicants with an ABET accredited bachelor degree in land surveying, 48 months. Should we account for the possibility of a master's or?
No, I don't know that there's a need to.
Okay.
I don't, I mean, there, yeah, I don't know that there's even the opportunity for it.
Okay.
Okay, so the university that I went to had a master's degree in land surveying, so I think we should take
account for it. So that
you
would
know,
be
if it's out there, we
a 60-month
recognition of it.
Okay.
Was it ABET accredited?
Yes, University of New Brunswick, Eastern Canada. It was. Uh-huh. And then the other thing is that when I became a registered land surveyor, I got credit for the fact that I had an engineering degree. Hmm. Maybe because I was so heavy from that university and land surveying courses, or just because it was an engineering degree.
Yeah, you probably got the 36 months as engineering related to serving. You got experience credit as well, right, when you applied?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. So this would only apply to people, this paragraph A, we're talking about education credit only. So I'll add in the possibility of a master's degree in land surveying for 60 months credit. Are we good with that?
Do you want to give 36 months credit for surveying, for a non-surveying time?
Well, I gotta raise the red flag here because where are we at? We're at 72 months right now for your license.
True.
Now you're
60 months would leave 12 months. That would give a year of experience. I suppose that worked. Yeah.
Okay. That came in.
No, 96 months for a license.
No, not
for engineers,
surveyors.
But surveyors only 72. Need 72.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh. I mean, never
but just like Chris, you're saying that if you want to become a registered land surveyor now, you couldn't be an engineer. You couldn't use your engineering experience towards that.
No, you could. You just have to relate it to surveying. You know, you could work for an engineering firm, have engineers sign off as your supervisors, and get some credit towards your surveying registration.
But your engineering degree wouldn't count and give you 48 months towards that.
Probably not.
No, not for this evaluator.
Yeah.
If you can demonstrate there's classes in there, I guess, but it's got to be, this says an engineer or a survey degree, so.
So Bob asked a good question, though. Should we write in a circumstance like what Michelle went through? You get 36 months education credit for surveying with engineering? How did you word that?
Well, you get a bachelor's in civil engineering, but you only have 3 hours of surveying in there. So should you? What kind of credit should you get that for that? For a surveying?
There's a place on the form that allows for other opportunities than this four-year degree. So it allows the assessor to evaluate something less than a four-year degree and apply that time.
Okay, all right. That's
so it's just on the evaluator's judgment.
Well, I think there's something there that says if you have, you know, a class in land surveying and it was so many credit hours, it's worth so many hours of experience time or so many months of experience time.
Okay, sounds good. Thank you.
I know when I do this, the model I follow is it's written somewhere. There's an equation or something that says the amount of credit hours equals so many months of experience. So when I look at something, if somebody has a degree in like an associate's degree in land surveying and construction technology, there's some of that that can be applied per credit hour equivalent of months in experience.
If we go to the top of page 14, I think that's what Jason's talking about, mm-hmm. where we talk about the board grants other education credit according to the following. So, pro rata credit shall be granted for completion of courses substantially equivalent to courses contained in the pertinent degree program. What do you guys think?
Yeah, just leave it at that.
Leave it?
Yeah, otherwise, yeah.
And then we took out my favorite thing in probably this whole rules package is the fact we struck E, where we take out the requirement that you only get 12 months credit, because I've always thought this penalized the really hardworking applicants who, oh, Bob doesn't agree.
No, I don't agree.
See, you should have been at the last LNR. Yes, that's where we talked about this. Because some people work full-time and go to school full-time, and we only gave them 12 months credit for 12 months' time.
Yeah.
You're such an engineer.
And
you're such an engineer.
Yes, I am. And what about, now you're going to get the argument, what about the guy that typically works 60 hours a week at his job? Works 6 days a week, you know, or something like that. Then I should get more than 12 months time for that, because you're only giving 12 months time for 40 hours a week. Or then, you know, you just start getting it into it.
It's a slippery slope.
It's a slippery slope. I mean, it's a whatever, so.
Okay.
This is up to the board.
How do your colleagues here feel about that?
I know, the architects are starting to think about it. If you get an internship for a semester, they'll give you an extra 3 months or 4 months of practice. So, I mean,
yeah.
I think it goes against everything that we've said about it. You know?
Well, and you know, if Bob, who is so nice, says it, just imagine how J-Matt's going to react when he sees it.
J-Matt? Yeah, Jason and I saw eye to eye on this one, that's for sure. Yeah.
So what do you think? Should I take it out? I struck it because you guys agreed last month, that last time we met, that we could try it. But now Bob's here.
Well, I think it needs to be there. I mean, it's realistic, at least in land surveying, for somebody to work all day and go to school at night. I mean, some people have to eat while they go to school.
So 12 months credit for a 12-month period of time, huh?
Yep.
Okay. I'll put it back in.
And you have some people that are sitting on the board. They can express their experience into the.
Oh, you think we should strike it, Jason?
Yeah, oh, I think. Well, what do you do? I mean, if somebody works, let's say that somebody works full time, and they work for whatever period while they go to school, and they go to school part time, can they only claim, let's say, 4 years of work experience or whatever work experience? Does that negate the fact they have a degree? That they got a degree in their spare time instead of going out and jet skiing or whatever on the weekends? I don't think so. I mean, the table could be turned where if somebody claims the experience, you're negating the degree that they've gained.
Okay, now you have somebody post-education working for his 4 years of experience, and he's working 60 hours a week. Are we going to grant him a year and a half for every year he works?
Correct me if I'm wrong, but there might be something written somewhere that says max 40 hours per week on the form.
Yeah, but that gets struck later on. That gets struck later on.
Right.
Yeah. As part of this revision. So to me, it's 1 year is 1 year. I mean, when we've been through this with. I mean, I fought many applicants on this that came in and said, well, I worked 2 months over the summer. Why don't I get this extra 2 months? And we said, well, how can I give you 14 months for 12 months of time? And we fought this on the, I mean, Like I said, you three are on the board. You guys are the going to be the final determination what goes forward.
And here's my take on it. I mean, we're kind of looking at it as if it's a traditional educational process where they're going to be going to school for 9 months. And what Jason's alluding to is that student that's working full-time and going to University of Phoenix. Not they have a land surveying program, but you know, they're in a situation like that where they're doing night courses or doing online courses or doing whatever, and it may take them 6 years to get their 4-year degree.
There's no problem, give them the time.
But we need to, and so I mean, we just need to make sure that we reconcile that they've got potentially 6 years of experience and they have a degree.
I don't have a problem with that, and we have done that. We have shown that people went to work part-time, went to school part-time, in 6 years they got their degree, and we gave them 2 years of credit for it, of work experience, and 4 years of... Yeah. But just because somebody works 3 months over the summer between, you know, first off, a lot of those months are probably what you would call sub-professional, so you only get certain amount of months there. And so that's just my opinion. Like I said, you three are on the board. You guys are the ones that are determining what goes forward or not.
Bill, you want to weigh in on this?
Well, my only concern, I guess, about later on we save hours for hours worked is everybody claims they work 60 hours a week.
Yep.
Every engineer that I know in the consulting business claims they work 60 hours a week.
And architects say 80, but that's
Melissa, what time
do you get? But, you know, I mean, it's very difficult.
It's just you. We know Neil doesn't work anything like that.
It takes engineers 60 hours to do 40 hours of work.
For sure. Well, and I think we're still kind of in this mindset of seat time. And professions are evolving away from
seat time. Okay, so what should I do? Keep the strike or take the strike out and keep E?
I think it makes it much simpler for the reviewer if there's a, you know, if we say 12 months experience, that means 12 months experience. It doesn't matter whether you work 60 hours a week, 80 hours a week, or how many hours a week you work. I think it's difficult.
Well, I can understand where somebody's working part-time and give them part-time credit, but somebody's working 20 hours a week and wants to get a year experience out of that, that's another thing, too. I mean, I guess you got to put a ceiling, if nothing else.
Well, what if we do one credit for 1 hour worked up to a maximum of 2,080 hours per year?
Okay, and then by definition, that's 30 hours 40 is hours. 60 hours of, no, 30 hours of education is... 2,080 hours, and then you cannot have more than 2,080 hours in a year. Right? That's the way.
Yeah.
You know, two semesters of work or whatever, 45 hours, 45 quarters.
I kind of like the way it says it in E then, if we're going that way. Provided the total month's credit granted in a period does not exceed the number of months in that period.
Yeah.
I mean... So we're talking about keeping E. All right.
Yeah.
That's easier than going to the hours level.
Yeah.
And, you know, 6 years from now, everybody would have worked 60 hours a week, or I was working for this engineering company 25 hours a week or something.
Yeah.
All
right.
So maybe we leave E in.
Yep. But then we did strike, if we look at B... The board shall credit work experience, 1 hour credit for 1 hour worked.
Up to a maximum of 2,080.
Do you want me to put that in?
I don't know. What do you guys think?
See, how do you verify that?
Yeah.
Well, you can't.
Yeah.
So you're looking, and you can say, okay, well, the supervisor's going to verify that. 99% of these supervisors...
They just sign it.
And send it out.
Yeah.
I mean, very few, and you know, and very few do you even get remarks back on them.
Well, what it does is it just puts the burden on the evaluator to say, okay, you know, they were going to school half time, and
then you got the kid coming in, the gentleman or lady coming in and arguing with the board. I deserve more time for this.
because I worked full-time while I went to school part-time.
Yeah.
And see, I guess I tend to evaluate the body of work, if you will, as a whole, and go, okay, they've got a...
You're such an architect.
They've got a degree which gives them 48 months of credit. So now I can grant them, over that same four-year period, I can still grant them 2 years of work experience or something.
Yeah, but you also have it easy because we've required AXP.
Right.
So...
I don't have to get into all
of this. Yeah, whereas the engineers, surveyors, geologists do.
Yeah.
Do you calculate? You don't have too much issue with the calculations either.
No. No, we actually do have it easy.
Yeah, you have it easier than the engineers and the surveyors.
So I'm going
to... You know, I'm kind of cozying up to leaving E in there.
Yeah.
I think it was Bill that looked at it from the perspective of months, not days, but months. And when you say 12 months experience, I mean, that's, you know, January to January. Whatever happens in between happens. I can kind of wrap my head around that and be comfortable with that. If you are just a better person and go to school and work, well, thank you for existing.
Yeah, and you're getting experience as far as your employer is concerned.
I see the downside of it, too, where we're going to have people trying to really exploit it, and it seems like there's a strong possibility that somebody could exploit this rather than a remote possibility.
Well, we get requests every month. You know, say we get 100 apps a month. We probably get 3 or 4 people arguing over how much credit they should get.
Yeah, because they got work over the
right.
summer, and I worked
right.
8 hours a week at,
right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we do.
Yeah.
Every month we get people arguing.
And the ones I'm evaluating at most have a four-year architectural degree where they're going to get 48 months, and then all I'm looking at is 12 months. And I don't see a lot of overlap because a lot of them, if they took 4 years to get the four-year degree, they were working hard.
Yeah.
At least by architect standards.
will this work?
Making sure their colored pencils are sharp. Yeah, you don't use those anymore.
No students know what those are.
This will work the same for geology and landscape architects, so we're good. All right.
I'd like to ask Michelle real quick before we close this. Michelle, do you have any thoughts on this? I mean, was this your circumstance when you were going to school?
I did work and I did go to school at the same time. I worked 40 hours and I was doing my engineering degree.
Yeah.
So what are your feelings on it?
I think we're going to have to apply common sense at some point in time where if somebody says they're working 60 hours, because even though a project engineer or manager will say they work 60 hours and we know about 20 hours of that is management, usually people who are applying for their registration are in production roles, and so if they say they work 60 hours, that it is potentially realistic that they're working 60 hours. And I think you'd have to look on that on a case-by-case basis, and I don't know if there's an ability to do that with the text that we have. Maybe it is there. But I think whoever's doing the review would have to be able to say, yes, they went to school full-time, because we can look at their credit hours, and... but as far as the work hours, the supervisor, you know, is supposed to be acting in integrity, and when they're reviewing these documents, and if they aren't, I don't think we have any control over that. But I think if somebody was working, I don't think they'd be working 60 hours and going to school full time, but if they say that they work this many hours, then we have to, and somebody signs off on that, then we have to trust that that's really what happened.
Well, and there's always an appeal right, Jason, to the full board. So, you know, what we normally do is if we get a request from an applicant that says, I think I was not given enough credit, we talk with the evaluator and we will put the concern on an agenda so the full board can discuss it. And they can always, you know, change an evaluation result if they feel the applicant's made a good showing, you know.
Mm-hmm. I think the only downside I see is that somebody's degree or their extra effort to go to school might be negated through leaving this, but the good side is if you work more than 40 hours a week, your compensation is your overtime pay. I mean, if you're just working, it's my personal belief that 40 hours is what you get. You know, you get paid for your overtime, have fun with that. But what I really am concerned with is that somebody's degree becomes negated by the time that they've worked out of necessity. Make sense?
And I get that. And honestly, I don't understand what the sentence says, so I'm not sure whether to eliminate it or not. I think if I worked, now I didn't do this for many semesters, I only did it for one semester to graduate, but if I had done that for the entire year, worked and gone to school, I guess what sentence could we put in here to make sure that I got credit for that time, for both of those efforts?
Well, I think my old thought is you start opening this up, you start opening up the door for all sorts of other things, trying to get credit for all sorts of stuff. I was working full-time and I took 12 hours of engineering on the side. So now, therefore, I want that applied towards my master's or something, you know, it's that type of thing. So, I mean, you know, you start getting all this, playing these games back and forth where we've been doing it this way for almost 100 years. Not that we should continue to do it just because we've been at 100 years, but it's worked very well, and it's a standard that which... and besides, I think, well, from a structural engineering point of view, okay, if I got a kid out of school, he's not doing structural engineering. He's doing drafting, he's doing other stuff, but he's not really gaining structural engineering experience that he would get after his four-year degree and then doing work. It's not the type of experience he's getting is not the same. Now, I know civil is a little more easier on the than that, but probably not quite the same. And I don't know, you know, you using other degrees would have to tell me what you thought of that, but I could just say from a structural engineering point of view, I wouldn't consider the experiences the same.
Okay. And that's a really good point. That's a really good point. Even in civil engineering, you're going to be designing, but you're not going to be you're going to be learning design, but it's really only after you get your degree that I would count that time. So, you know, that is a good thought.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, when you're, you know, maybe a junior, you're doing WL squared over 8, which is simple beam calcs, versus doing sophisticated analysis after you've gotten a bachelor's degree.
Right, the kind of experience you would want to be counting toward getting your registration comes after you get your degree.
So let me ask this question then: is it a remote possibility that somebody's going to claim school and work at the same time?
They do it all the time.
Yeah, it happens.
Okay.
Work the summer. I did this. I did that. I did all this other stuff.
What we see a lot of is I went to school full time and I worked 20 hours a week. We see that. And how come I can't get, you know, credit for both? And we say the rule says you get 12 months credit for 12 months time.
Yeah, I think I have to be in favor of leaving it in then. I really do at this point. I mean, unless something changed, but like Bob said, do we want to open up that can of worms?
Yeah. Okay.
It's a never-ending can of worms.
It is.
Yeah.
And it's good we discuss it because, you know, it's an industry-specific concern. You know, like Bob said, they're not really designing. They're learning design or, you know, they're
doing drafting.
Right.
They're doing stuff that's necessary that somebody has to do, but they're not necessarily using an engineering performance.
Engineering judgment.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it doesn't seem to me this is a great hardship on the applicants. I mean,
it's an extra idea.
Yeah, they may think it's a big hardship, but in reality it doesn't seem to me that it is in terms of, you know, their career and where they're going.
Well, and I think we can justify it if we were to be scrutinized as being burdensome in this rule on someone's ability to get registered, which is a likelihood given our legislature and our governor's office, that we can say because these professions are so highly technical the experience has to be in addition to education, because education is not professional work.
Health, safety, and welfare.
Right, health, safety, and welfare. Yep. Right.
Do you want somebody right out of school designing your water treatment plant at Flint, Michigan?
Right. Right. Well, yeah.
Or deciding that you don't need a water treatment plant.
Yeah. Use the shitty river water that has lead in it. Great. They don't have geologists registered there in Michigan anyway.
Let's take a break, folks, on the phone.
Hey, I'm going to stay on the line and take a break at the same time.
Thank you.
In master's degree versus an advanced degree, does anybody... the only concern I have is the one I expressed earlier, that a master's degree is just one possible advanced degree, and it's limiting.
You want to just say master's / doctorate and let it go? Because that's the way it's been for...
That's fine,
yeah.
Okay.
In all the disciplines, right?
Yeah, you're right, because my son wasn't going to get his master's degree for a long time. Just went right for his doctorate, and at the last minute he saw he could get... They bump his wages up at the school if he got his master's degree. He said, oh, well, but just apply for my master's degree. So he got an extra $5 an hour.
Well, I know that I know some students today who don't, you know, if they go on for a doctorate degree, they don't get a master's
degree. They just keep on going,
How about if I just make the language the same in all the categories? Because we have the language I think you like for the engineers where we say...
or a master's or doctorate.
Or doctorate degree. So that's fine. Do that for geology, surveying, and landscape architecture.
Yep.
Yeah. We've got to really like flowers to get a doctorate in landscape art.
You're missing the hatred look that Leva just flashed off.
I know. I've taken a lot from him today. I had to get some money.
So what did we do with B then? Where does B now stand under?
B, how we credit work experience.
Yeah.
We took out 1, 2, and 3 and modified it to be, the board shall credit work experience as follows. B1, 1 hour credit for 1 hour worked. And then 2, experience shall be verified by the employer before the board grants the credit.
I see. That's
problematic.
I think it will be. But...
Well, the language is pretty similar. The gentleman liked the word verified better than substantiated. Mm-hmm. And then...
you want to say not to exceed 2080 in there? Because then you want to do the same vote you did on the other one.
You mean in Section 1? Where we say 1 hour credit for 1 hour work?
Not to exceed 2080 in 1 year? I mean, if you want to do that.
Yeah, otherwise, I think if there's not some sort of limit on it, you're basically struggling with every single applicant who comes in and you know, wants to get the maximum amount out of it.
This is also going to require you to go to employers and ask them for payroll. Right? Because somebody says, I work full-time, and okay, what's your proof? Okay, now I got to go to my employer and get a payroll slip.
Right now they sign off on the application. They sign off on the COE that says this employee worked these hours.
But then are you going to accept that they say this employee worked, well, if we're going to say maximum of 2080, I guess it doesn't matter.
So do you prefer the language that's there, which to me seems confusing, between 85 and 129 hours? And
I'm going to throw a wrench in this, because on our COE forms, we ask for months. We don't ask for hours.
That's true. Yeah.
We ask number of hours worked per week, but we ask for the number of months.
Good point.
Yeah, I think that makes more sense to me than trying to you know, trying to figure out on an hour-by-hour basis.
That would really be burdensome.
Yes, it would be.
So you like 1 hour credit for 1 hour work, not to exceed 2080 in a year?
Well, I like...
Or should we do the months?
is there a legal definition of full-time employment, like something the Department of Labor does or something?
There is. Actually, it's in our statutes, isn't it? The part and full-time work is defined?
That's what we're crossing
out
here.
That's what we're striking out of
right.
our rules. That's right.
Well, 2080 is the recognized
full-time.
Yeah, that's 40 times 52.
Right.
But usually it's over 30-something hours or 24 hours or something like that.
It's like
considered part-time.
Over 30 hours a week is considered full-time.
That's why I think you just leave this in there and let it up to this, leave it in as written and leave it up to discretion of the evaluator after that.
Without putting a maximum?
Well, maximum is 2080, but it says, you know, it says 130 hours or work or more. A month, does it say, or more per month is considered 1 month work experience.
Oh, I see. Leave it.
Leave that in. And 85 to 129 is part-time. Nobody's going to tell you only worked 85 to 129 unless he comes out. And then that way you don't get people coming in and with the 60-hour-a-week thing and all that crap.
I was on
salary because that's why my payroll is not going to show me that I work more than 60 hours a week. And, you know...
Yeah.
So go back to
I like that.
You like going back to the way it was?
Yeah.
Okay.
But Ed's point is a good one, where we're talking about hours instead of months. Although...
Well, no, because this translates.
This translates to months. Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
It's equivalent to 1 month. Yeah.
Okay.
One half month, yeah.
130 hours is what? 30-something hours?
Because what it says 130 hours or more of work per month is equal to 1 month of work.
Yeah.
So if you work 180 hours in a month, it's still 1 month.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because
mm-hmm.
that's the or more.
Okay.
So
we'll keep what we have. And then, are we ready to move to 209? It's the time frames processing. The time frames in 2009 and 2010, again, the main change was to change in training to fundamentals, and we struck the home inspector requirement for hold the home inspector application for a year because their certification is only good for a year. And then we struck number two because what we're doing here is not denying them, we're closing so as not to harm their ability to reapply.
Yeah, were you ever, to answer the question, were you ever denied an application?
We do, if the person has... lack of good moral character, and then we added five down here. We deny the applicant, provide written notifications, pretty much the same language, it's just we made it a denial rather than within the process for what is essentially a closure of an application.
That makes sense to me. I mean, you don't want to negatively impact somebody just for some reason.
Right. And you'll see the big difference in Rule 210 is we shortened the time frame for processing applications to sit for the exams, and it now matches the application time for professional registration or certification. So hopefully they'll be happy to see that we're processing things. We process more quickly than this, but you know,
mm-hmm.
I think it's important.
It easier.
And then Ed, in 214, that's the architect registration. Right. Rather than name it AXP, I just said the board's professional training the board's professional experience requirement, because who knows, in 2 years they could change the name again.
Some other group will get uppity about being AXPers instead of interns, and they'll change the name again.
Yeah.
And
then
whine really loud.
We struck number three, Ed, because I think if we, with striking it,
which one?
214, number three.
Three, yeah.
Because we made it 96 months, and if we don't make it 96 months, then maybe some of these accelerated programs, or we don't have to look beyond how many hours they had in AXP, that sort of thing. So
we strike it.
So we're good.
No, I'm
okay.
Good with that.
Now, we did nothing with Rule 221, Bob, because you weren't here and we didn't feel like redefining all the engineering branches.
I don't feel like redefining them either.
Okay. I guess, are you happy with the structural definition?
Where is it?
Make sure the building doesn't fall down.
Looks good to me.
Okay.
Civil looks good too.
Good.
How do the exams work in all of these things?
The applicant just goes online and registers for each of the whichever individual exam they want, and
so NCWS provides nuclear and mining and all the ones that
we
list here.
Everyone that's listed.
They actually provide more than what we list here now. They have a computer engineer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was going to say, did we get the software engineer in here?
Yeah, we never were interested.
What about
in
software
that.
Architects?
They really don't care about color.
Stop it.
Actually, I saw one for hair architects.
Hair architects.
Nice.
A building in Tucson.
Architects. And you've confirmed that these are still...
Obviously, I don't need their services.
Still valid exams.
And we still register people by these categories, so...
Get a reasonable amount of one every year. Yeah.
Except geological, of course. NCWS doesn't provide
right,
a geological.
Right, we do.
Exam.
Exactly.
Okay, so you're good on branches...
Yep.
Engineering training 222,
and you'll see that it does contain definitions for experience, Leroy, where, consultation, research, and all that are defined. So I think that's good because these definitions mirror what we use as criteria when we evaluate applications.
Okay. Well, going back to the branches again, sorry. If NCWS offers exams in others than what we have listed here, should they be listed here?
It's interesting because we as a board did consider that question a couple of years ago.
Yes,
when for software engineer.
Mm-hmm.
And some states are now offering it, and we wanted to wait and see how NCWS's exam numbers stacked up. And they're not. From what I've been able to glean. So the board wasn't inclined to authorize or create a new branch for software engineer. They wanted to wait, and I think that's probably wise because I don't know how many applications we would get for that.
Well, just again, my thought here is that is being restrictive, and the concern that we're getting pushback from the legislature and the governor's office on. We don't. It seems to me that there's, if NCWS is offering the examinations, maybe the board should recognize them regardless.
Well, I think the thought process was that, like for software engineering, most of the software being written for one of things was being written by electrical or mechanical engineers. Like if you're doing a SCADA system for a wastewater treatment plant or something like that, that's all being written by professionals that write that stuff. It's not like you're hiring somebody off the street and then putting them into that. So I think that's what we decided.
Yeah, I remember that discussion actually, but just reading this again, and in light of the recent concerns that have been raised about about making more difficult for people to get licensed. It's maybe something that, I'm just raising this.
Well, aren't we erring on the side of letting them earn a living by not having it in here?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Fewer
branches, we recognize the...
Yeah,
that's regulatory.
Right. Like, for instance, we have the civil designation, which is pretty broad.
Oh, yeah, everything.
In California, they've divided that out, and they offer a designation.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And that's another one of our frequent flyers.
Mm-hmm.
And he's a professional engineer in California, but he can't pass the civil exam, so he can't get registered in Arizona because we don't recognize that branch here. So.
I think that's just a California branch, too. It's not an NCA.
Right, no. Yeah. I think California gave the exam.
So in that sense, are we being more restrictive or less?
I think we're being less restrictive by not... I mean... You could, I mean, like at the software engineering, I think you could expand that out into you have to be a software engineer to do what? You know, here it's, you know, we're basically in the built environment and where things are one of a kind, not provided by industry. And so, you know, you need a higher standard level. But if, you know, like the Boeing jet, I mean, that thing gets built, it gets checked three different times. It's, you know, they do prototypes, they do all this stuff, and we don't get to do it. We don't get to build prototypes of our buildings and of our stuff in
wind tunnel testing.
You know, yeah, wind tunnel testing and all that stuff, you know.
Yeah.
Well, and every couple times a year, NCWS will send us notice that they're making modifications to an exam, like the mechanical or the civil or whatever. And the board has, in the past, looked over the proposed changes and said, yeah, that'll still fit with our expectations for the, you know, training proficiency demonstration for whatever the exam is in the branch that we recognize. And for instance, this coming board meeting, they are going to consider a proposal from an association to include plumbing engineering, more plumbing engineering questions on the mechanical exam. And see if it still meets, you know, our requirements. So we do review the branches periodically, and we look at the NCWS exams periodically to make sure we're still happy with our definitions and what we expect the exams to demonstrate.
Okay. Well, we
reviewed their revised definition on agricultural engineering.
Yeah, Leroy was particularly mad about it. They're testing things landscape architects do.
I also added architectural engineering.
Yes,
I don't know if you know. The architects are really pissed about that.
it's the fact they're using that word architecture.
That's right.
Yeah.
Side by side with engineering.
Yeah. It's an oxymoron.
We miss you, Bob.
Right.
Okay. Does that answer all your questions?
Yeah.
Okay.
So, I think most of this in training stuff, I think, unless somebody has comments, the home inspector's language, any comments there? It's on page 19.
Now, they're really happy with their rule 247.
I'm really... 47. Oh, yeah. I, you know, they wrote it. Unless we see something really glaring,
yeah.
I kind of rely on their expertise on that, quite frankly.
Mm-hmm. Like, subsection 6 under the rule was their grandfather provision,
right.
And they don't need that anymore. Everybody...
We're outside of that.
And
they're a candidate for grandfathering. They've been practicing it.
Yeah. And you know they've made some minor modifications to what's required on their reports, and you know they struck some of the other language. But yeah, I can't really tell you more because I don't know about home inspectors.
Let's jump to 254, landscape architect registration.
Yep, Leroy and I looked this over.
Then it must be perfect.
Yep.
Well, as close as you can come. Till an engineer reads it.
I was just going to say it's pretty as a flower.
Beautiful.
I've got a question on B7, editing or writing. The editing or writing for publication of articles, books, newsletters, or other written materials on landscape architectural subjects, maximum 6 month credit. How do you apply in months
writing
a written publication? I mean, how do you equate the work with the time?
You know, we used to have that under architects and we got rid of it, and I'm glad we did, because to me, I just don't see how you, like you said, Jason, I don't see how you document that, and does that really, is that really valuable experience? You're writing about stuff you already know.
Well, you know what they say, you don't really learn something until you teach it.
Teach it, true.
Well, the point is, it's more an exercise of learning how to write than it is the technical craft.
Yeah.
But the downside is, how do you evaluate it? What if I write something that's, I don't know, based on surveying, but not really a surveying textbook? I mean, does that apply? It just seems so subjective to me, because I could have a blog or I don't know, maybe I work with the New York Times and write every Sunday about what I think about surveying, but not necessarily anything but my opinion. So it's not really, there's not a technical foundation, or there's nothing in here that provides for a technical foundation for that writing.
I'd say take it out.
Yeah.
Okay.
We're done. Out.
Strike 7.
Okay. Now, if it was writing specifications, then it'd have some meat.
Yeah, and that falls under...
It falls under your designer.
Yeah,
design.
Specifications are specifically listed.
Yeah, they are, yeah.
Okay. We don't have assayers anymore, drug lab firms, on-site, blah, blah, blah. I'm so happy. Okay, Jason, 282.
And surveyor in training, 282, page 23.
Again, it looks kind of similar to the engineer in training.
I'm happy with all of this except for number 10, which is my same comments 30 seconds ago.
Okay.
Okay, let's take that out.
Everything else looks pretty sound to me. And Melissa, I don't know if you looked at your email this morning, but for the rest of the folks here, I went through and I tried to apply this to our application form. And I was pretty successful in doing it and making the definitions match with our statutory guidance, this language, and the way that we evaluate. So awesome. It seemed pretty strong when I did my exercise there.
Cool. So we're good to remove whatever it was that Stuart had created?
B10. B10 editing and writing publication.
Yeah, we're going to remove that. But I'm talking about that percentage sheet that Stuart came up with.
Yeah, I sent you a draft of a substitute for that.
Okay.
And it might be the something that we can put on the COE form.
Cool.
And I think if we handle it there, we don't have to change any of this.
Great. Perfect.
So we can go through that, and
we can do that after.
Let's see, where was this at? I did have one change. Let's see, that's actually in that. I was going to use a different word. No, I'm good with all this.
Okay, so it'll be 1 through... 10 then, after we remove the editing and writing. I really appreciate it, because this helps a lot in terms of what we use on our evaluation forms.
Mm-hmm.
So
that's
really good. Okay, and then 284 is land surveyor registration, And I just wanted, I made an effort, you may not like this language, so let me know, that the candidate shall first complete fundamentals, second, professional, provided by NCWS, and third, the Arizona State specific examination provided by the board. Just so we're clear.
That's fine.
That way they have to pass the other two before you guys have to proctor the test.
Right. Do you think it makes sense that the first and second ones are provided by the National Council and the third just
mm-hmm.
provided by the...
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So not confusing to you guys.
Yep.
Good.
Yep.
Are you okay with it, Jason?
Yeah, I'm good with it. Very good work, Melissa.
Michelle?
Yes, that works except for you said first, but you haven't said second and third.
Yeah.
Oh, wait.
No, I did.
Yeah, that's in there.
The candidate shall first...
I missed it.
Okay, and then second, and then third. Okay.
Okay, got it, yeah.
Cool. Are we ready for 301?
Yes.
Oh, mm-hmm. my God! Okay, we took out, which makes me happy, the descriptions of the felonies that we're interested in. So
right.
we say can't violate any state or federal criminal statute. And then...
Is that, you said felonies, is that, is it, does this mean felony?
No, it's actually, it could be any, I mean, I guess you could be charged with misdemeanor fraud. I don't know what it would be, but theft is misdemeanor. It depends on the amount. And then the same for the feds. You could be charged with...
So a traffic violation is not a criminal statute?
Right.
Well, some of it is. Like DUI is criminal. Reckless driving is criminal. Driving on a suspended license is criminal. But the rest...
What was wrong with the old description?
I think it's really limiting. And we are sometimes concerned about other things besides embezzlement, theft, forgery, that sort of thing. We'd be concerned about, you know, sex offenses, murder.
Why did we take out the reasonably related to registrant's area of practice?
I hate that.
Because
most lawyers, I deal with are not good at drawing the nexus. I am, because I'm a wonderful lawyer, as you know.
Well, we know that.
A lot of lawyers have a really hard time.
And honest.
Yes, and humble. Drawing that nexus. They say, well, if, you know, they were convicted of felony embezzlement, how does that relate to their ability to be an architect?
Well, we had an architect that was in for murder.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And
well,
he wanted to do drawings.
Well,
from
he could
the
be
first
a good architect.
I sat on
well,
the
and that's the thing. It's like
they
don't realize that you draw the connection through the moral character, good character requirement.
Right.
And that if your judgment is so bad and so impaired as to have led you down the embezzlement path, what's to keep that bad judgment from interfering with your ability to be a safe landscape architect, engineer, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the nexus, but it's hard for lawyers to make that connection. So this way, it's easier.
Okay, so we have a registrant shall not violate any state or federal criminal statute. So that applies to somebody that's already licensed.
Right.
And during their tenure of licensure, so if somebody goes back in time and says, I had that DUI in a million years ago, is there an impact from that on this, or from this on that?
It could be if you look at subsection 2, where registrant shall not engage in fraud, deceit, misrepresentation, but that's providing professional
services.
So, yeah, I don't know. I think if we don't catch them at the application stage, we're kind of stuck with them here in rules of conduct.
Well, my point is this. I mean, this is very black and white, and it says the registrant shall not violate any federal crime or statute.
Mm-hmm.
So when does that take effect? I mean, if the board hashes out somebody's criminal history and says, okay, we're good with this, is that abrasive with this rule, the board's discretion?
And I guess that's why I'm wondering, why don't we leave some semblance of it being reasonably related to the area of practice? I mean, that's always how we, since I've been on this board, that's how we've evaluated a lot of things. And it's like, okay, so they've disclosed a DUI.
You know, well, that is...
That's a violation of a state statute.
But that's a previous prior to, I mean...
Well, it could be while they were registered.
So you're saying...
Yeah, they may check off on their box as a part of the renewal, and so is that reasonably related? The answer is it depends.
Well, and you're right, because look at 4, we still left in... pertaining to the registrant's area of practice. So I guess it's definitely up to you. I'm not wedded to this by any stretch. If you guys want to keep in that reasonably related, I would say lose the list, but
I'm supportive of getting rid of the list of offenses. I just keep it a more of a blanket statement that then gives us, I think that gives us more flexibility in seeing how it applies to their area of practice. Because a sex offender, that could apply to their area of practice. If they're an architect doing schoolwork, you don't want them doing schoolwork. That allows us, maybe we don't deny their renewal or we don't deny their application or we don't revoke their license, but we may put a restriction on their practice that they're not allowed to do schoolwork.
Are you okay with that, Jason?
Well, if we add, the board may take action against a registrant's license or certificate if a violation of law is reasonably related. I think we got to have that whole statement from the board on there.
Yeah, we're going to leave that sentence in. We're just going to get rid of it.
Again, does this limit us? Does it limit anybody or our authority by saying a registrant shall not violate any state or criminal statute? Or are we limiting the board's discretion at this point?
I don't think so. Because the way it would read is a registrant shall not violate any state or federal criminal statute if a violation of law is reasonably related to a registrant's area of practice. So if we find out somebody has a felony DUI on renewal, the board can look at it and consider what was said in the police report. I mean, obviously, if it's a felony DUI driving a company truck on work hours, I would say that is reasonably related to their area of practice. But if it's a DUI maybe after hours, as a result of a holiday celebration or whatever, the board may take pity on the poor drunkard and go ahead and let them keep their license.
Not that she's prejudiced.
Right.
I mean,
I'm humble and very unprejudiced.
I'm getting hung up on the scowl. What about the language of if a registrant violates any state, federal crime statute, the board may take action? Does that make sense?
Doesn't a registrant shall put us in the same kind of position we were with alarm people that first go around?
Well, with shall, it means you absolutely have to
do it. And that's what we were faced with when we first had to take on their registration and we had no leeway.
Well, that's because we had the list. We were limited.
Yeah, we had a defined list, but also this says the board may take action. The registrant shall not violate.
Right.
Which to me, I'm fine with that.
Yeah, the board may take action.
What if a registrant does?
Well, then, and they get convicted? You know...
I mean, the point of this is to give the board discretion, isn't it?
Yeah.
So if we leave that sentence then that the board may take action against a registrant's license if a violation of law is reasonably related. So the board needs to decide first whether the offense is reasonably related to the practice area, and then they can take action, but they don't have to.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
We have to
I think the reasonably related really helps that.
Yes.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, I still don't like the registrant shall not violate any. I think that... it's too restrictive.
it's pretty common in professional practice. You don't want someone representing themselves as a registered geologist, not a trained geologist, but a registered geologist, going out there and robbing banks or embezzling money or molesting children or whatever. And to say that is not a bad thing, because what you're doing is saying, this relates directly to health, safety, and welfare.
We're here. Actually just had our first geologist case since I've been on this board, and it was a guy who falsified mineral reports in a mining scam. And he came under federal investigation and was convicted in federal court of fraud and deceit.
You got that one on file, right?
This also says
violated. It doesn't say convicted.
Well, and I think that maybe that's more.
Well, if you violated the law, then you can't violate the law unless you're convicted. Otherwise, you're innocent unless proven guilty, right?
No, I mean, you can do something to violate
and not get caught.
Well, yeah.
But you're not going to probably not going to disclose that if you're running around violating federal laws. But.
You know, really, Melissa, none of us shall violate any federal or criminal statute, right?
Correct.
That's a cultural.
Well,
that's every U.S.
I think the point I'm trying to make is it seems to read to me, anyways, that we're giving the board discretion to take an action when this happens. So maybe that first statement in my mind should be directed to an if or a when. When it does happen, the board can take an action. Rather than just saying, I don't know, maybe I'm reading too much into this.
So you would change it to read, if a registrant violates any state or federal criminal statute, the board may take action against the license or certificate if it's reasonably related to the practice area.
Yeah.
Well,
when a registrant violates those things, you know, then just as you said.
I know exactly why it says shall not violate rather than convicted of, because the health reg boards don't care if you've had a misdemeanor expunged or if you went on some kind of deferred prosecution. They want to know what the actual act you were accused of having committed was. So they'll want to look at the police reports to see what you were originally charged with. But they don't really care if you fled or, you know, whatever. So that's why I think that language is a similar old remnant vestige from the health reg boards. They have similar language. Which isn't to say you need that. If you feel that's too egregious and engineers are awesome or whatever and they would never do this, then...
Engineers will do it.
What if I have an applicant that was maybe his immigration status or something was questionable at some point or in violation of the law, but...
Right.
He's a good engineer, you know, I mean, it just seems too absolute for no purpose.
Well,
that's my problem with it, too, and I think it absolutely has to have the proviso that it's related to the area of practice. I think that's an absolute necessity.
Okay. I'd like to see a prosecutor at heart, Bill, so just bear with me.
But I think it's just, I think it's... too absolute and too broad as it's currently structured.
So do you like Jason's proposed modification?
I think that would work.
We take out the
shall.
He violates or she violates? Okay.
Does that
mean
you have to take action one way or the other?
No. I think we just say if a registrant violates any state or federal...
The county and cities are okay. County and city laws are okay.
Well, that's four. True. A registrant shall comply with state, muni, and county laws, codes, and ordinances pertaining. Well, I think that is much more directed to your practice because, for instance, Ed makes plans. Those plans get delivered to city planning offices, and they have to approve. That's how I see that part of the rule.
Yep.
Pertaining. Whereas I see five
being
the criminal.
You're saying it's more of a criminal type. Okay.
Yeah. You know, four would be the jurisdiction where you submit your plans to, mm-hmm. right? And they have their own ordinances and regulations, that sort of thing. But 5 deals specifically with the criminal law.
Gotcha.
Yeah, I'm okay with that part, with that interpretation. Like, yeah.
Okay, so I'll propose what 5 says is if a registrant violates any state or federal criminal statute, the board may take action against that registrant's license or certificate if the violation is reasonably related to the registrant's area of practice.
Perfect. I'm okay with that.
Sounds good.
Yeah.
Okay. And that way you get to determine if the criminal transaction is directly related to the practice, and even if you do determine that, you may or may not take action. So I think it gives the board more discretion.
Exactly. Yeah, I'm for that.
Any others that you're
down?
Oh,
14. Oh, go ahead, Jay.
Down in 13, we've got an address for ADLS that is somebody's personal address.
Oh, right. Oh, yeah. I remember you said that. How about if we just take that out and put a period at after?
.org.
Yeah, .org.
Yeah, okay. Great.
Is the April 12th, 2001 the correct date, Jason?
It was when we did the 5-year rules review.
Okay. Might not hurt just to check to make sure. I'm assuming it hasn't been updated, but...
Well, April 2001 is what's been accepted by everybody.
Okay.
The ATLS has lodged a new set, and I think it's incumbent upon them to get their snoot in the door here.
Okay.
Yeah, maybe by the time these are posted, they'll have a new standard or something they want us to consider.
Michelle, are you wearing your ATLS hat today?
I am.
Okay. This is good information to take back.
Okay. Okay, I will definitely take it back then. Yeah, I'm taking it all back.
Okay.
Should.
Go ahead.
Looking at it in terms of changing rules and difficulty in changing rules, is there a way to write this without having these specific dates in here? The most current or something like that? Or the most
recent?
I tried that.
GERT usually fix it out when you don't put something.
That's how I know April 12, 2001 is the date, because in the past 5-year rules review, they made me put it in.
Yeah.
So.
Okay. All right.
Paragraph 14, I'm just curious, you added on or become the subject of a board disciplinary investigation. We have a lot of these little registrant shalls in here that don't carry that same language. I'm just wondering why we picked that one.
I don't have a note as to why you guys wanted that.
So we don't want anybody messing around with us.
Was that something, Doug, that... maybe an investigation wanted, or?
I mean, because the same could be said of 16,
I don't know,
15, I thought...
Yeah, that's a good point, yeah.
It's just we have all this parallel language about a registrant shall, and then we only tag on, it almost sounds like, well, if you don't update your address, or if you don't, if you sign the documents not prepared by you or your bona fide employee, you're not going to be subject to board disciplinary investigation.
We can just take it out. I don't know why.
I would either take it out or put it. You have to take it out, or you have to put it in all of them.
Well, it's easy enough to just take it out and not put it in all.
I think further up in this, it kind of reads that any of these actions, any of these things, could subject you to board disciplinary action. Home inspector rules 30101. I don't think we had anything there. They got changes, but. Again, I think.
Yeah, they get really upset about this pay directly or finder's fee and all that.
Oh, yeah.
So they're always referring to that. So
I thought this is a good change.
That's really good. We've actually had a few enforcement cases about that.
Yeah. Well, and they discussed that quite a bit last week.
Yeah, Leroy came and listened.
Yeah.
Sorry.
It's okay.
Can I say something about 13 again? Thank you for bringing it to my attention, because now I look at it more intensely. And somebody said, do we have to put a date in there? Is it okay for me to go back to this?
Sure.
Certainly.
Okay. So if we have subsequent versions, updated versions, later versions, we have to revise the rules in order to get those incorporated?
Yes. Yeah. Unfortunately.
Ouch.
I know.
That's from word from on high, not our own doing.
Right. I mean, so think about it, Michelle. It's a 16-year-old standard.
Uh-huh.
Is that still the standard in the surveying community?
Okay. Well, we'll talk about that. And yeah.
So if
I mean,
you
there's
guys,
no way. Sorry.
Yeah. If you guys want us to consider a new standard, we should know about that, put it on an agenda, and have the board act on a new standard and then propose a change to this rule.
Okay. All right, because I know we are in discussions about that, so.
Great.
Okay, thank you.
The only change, gentlemen, Leroy suggested to Rule 303 is add professional back into the definition of registered professional landscape architects. We're good with that, Leroy, right?
Uh-huh.
So we're still registered professional engineer, registered geologist.
Geologist on professional?
Well, you know, that comes up a lot in discussions in the geology community. You know, am I a professional geologist or am I a registered geologist? And is that the reason for this in the landscape architects?
Landscape architects across the country, because there was so much. Some states they were registered, some states they were licensed, some states they were professional. So landscape architects across the country have gone PLA, professional landscape architect. But in Arizona, we're also registered.
Yeah, it's been tradition here that they refer to themselves as registered. It's only recently that the national push has been to call themselves professional. So why not put both in and then you're happy. Do you want to propose adding professional for geologists?
I would, I think, because in some states you are a professional geologist. You're licensed as a professional geologist, I think, and not registered as one.
And that differentiates
and
gives you a little more credence under what happened last year.
Yeah, versus trained geologists. Yeah. So registered professional. Now, that begs the question for architects. No? Okay.
They're not even professional.
We're not professionals.
You're just AIA, which just irritates me. But.
Well, we're not just that either. We only.
And the humor in the landscape architect proposing that was that when they brought it up, I listened to the discussion up and down and around every corner, and finally I said, you know, you all don't have the dilemma I have, because if I put PLA after my name, my ex-wife will wonder why I'm using her maiden name. Her maiden name was Pla.
Be very confusing. Yeah, Leroy was really funny at the time. It also begs the question for you, Jason. Do you think surveyors would want to be recognized as professional, registered professional land surveyor, or we're just good with RLS and that's that?
RLS is fine. Okay. You know, nationally they refer to me as a PS, a professional surveyor.
Right.
And you'll see that in the publications. I'm a PLS in Colorado and RLS in Arizona and something in Nevada. So I don't think it's a big deal here.
Okay.
It's whatever each state says. And we're comfortable with RLS.
Okay.
So does this mean geologists and landscape architects got to go out and get a new seal?
Well, that depends on the use of seals thing that we'll look at next. Do you think they should?
I guess the way I read this is it gives them the flexibility of either calling themselves a registered landscape architect or a professional landscape architect.
Yeah, one or the other.
One or the other, but
so you
could
order
a registered professional. But I don't know if that would all fit. You have to start spiraling the text in.
I think it will. I looked at it.
Well, you know what we could do to make it either or without making a big deal is just put a comma after registered, professional landscape architect. I think that infers that they could refer to themselves one way or another.
Yeah. Or all of the above.
Or all of the above, exactly. Same for geologists. And your stamp says registered professional. You have both.
Professional engineer.
It doesn't say registered professional?
I don't think so.
Interesting.
I don't know. I don't look at it very often anymore.
I looked at some plans that we had, and it was registered professional engineer.
That's
maybe it does.
I was just
going to see if I can find something in here.
Because if you look on the last page, I think we have our... No, I think I took it off. Sample expiration date notice. Yeah, I didn't include the Appendix A. But it does say Appendix A says engineers have to list their branch. So.
Yeah.
So it says professional engineer, structural professional engineer, civil, whatever.
Yeah.
I don't remember the register part. But.
All right. Should we jump down to use of seals?
I have to run.
So you're going to add professional for geologists, right?
Form, so we're good.
So it'll read like the engineer, the landscape architect, and geologist will be the same. Thanks, Bob.
Thank you,
Bob.
Good if you have any notes or whatever you want me to have, just...
No, I think you got them.
Awesome.
Okay, use of seals.
So the big change there, guys, was taking out the requirement to put a date and
a
signature.
I think just about everybody here in this room agreed to it. I don't know about Mr.
Yeah, Chairman. I know. Just time for him to leave. So, do you think any of the other parts of that rule need to...
I was looking at...
Oh, I didn't actually look at this... the placing of the stamp. Let's see.
While I was looking for that, I'm going to go up to upper paragraphs, like 3, 4. There's some terminology here that I find rather odd. Under 4, either the cover, index page, or first sheet of each addenda or change order to specification. Addenda I can see, because we'll issue addendum during bidding, and you seal that, and it becomes a part of the specifications. Change orders generally are a financial document that document changes. They document the dollar and time modifications to a contract. And I don't classify them. I don't seal change orders. I may seal supporting documentation that goes along with the change order, be it a revision drawing, a modification to a specification, or something like that. I may seal that.
I wonder if engineers.
But do you change orders? Change orders frequently are changes to the design.
Yeah,
but highway projects.
Do they
the
have
financial
to
part of it is a whole nother.
I'm
area.
Glad you're weighing in because I don't deal with highway stuff. So
it's a term of art for engineers then. Okay, so we should probably leave it.
Okay, but I just don't want to see an architect get in trouble because he didn't seal a change order.
Well, and I think your ability to distinguish is the important part,
right?
That your change orders are purely financial or contractual, and
right.
You don't have to seal those. Because they don't affect your design, right?
Well, they may, but the design documents that come in, I mean, there's an AIA form for change orders. And it says, here's the previous contract amount. The contract amount will be adjusted by this amount. The contract time will be extended by this amount. And the architect, the owner, and the contractor sign it. And it modifies the contractor's contract.
It's not a professional document.
It's technically not, to me, not a professional document. I don't seal my contract with the owner.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
Well, this says change order to specifications. It doesn't say the contract. Does that?
Change order to plans. It should be plans and specifications.
Maybe plans and specifications.
Or contract documents, just to keep it.
Or contract documents. Yeah, you're right.
Well, contract documents would be the contract.
No, contract documents are the specifications and plans.
Yeah,
are included in contract
documents.
That's what
they consider contract documents. At least that's how architects.
And that's how.
How ADOT looks at it.
Uh huh.
So maybe we should add those words. Say.
And it seems like there's some. I almost feel like we need to look this over because we've got each sheet of drawings or maps. And then we have east of the master sheets, and then we've got project specifications under 3, and then we've got bound details when prepared, and then we've got under 6, we talk about any report, specification, or other professional document. And we have specifications listed like 2 or 3 times in here.
Hmm.
But it really hasn't caused, I guess as I look back at it in hindsight, it really hasn't caused any problems, and so maybe we just leave it alone.
I mean, if you think it's confusing, though, it wouldn't be a bad time to try to fix it.
Well, it may just be me that thinks it's confusing.
No.
You see what I'm
saying? I think there's some things in here that are old verbiage.
Six and seven do seem to be have a little bit of conflict to me too, where it says on 6, either the cover-based item and so forth of a professional document. And then the next one says the signature line of any letter or other professional document.
Well, and quite honestly, I don't seal every letter that goes out of my office.
No.
I don't seal a fee proposal.
Either the cover, file, index, or table of
contents. Can you patch me into Doug Parlin real quick?
He's sitting right
taking
here.
Taking notes.
Doug, take a note. What,
I'm going to make him really, really busy because every fee proposal I get from an engineer doesn't have a seal on it.
Oh,
either.
Man.
So we're going to get... The board's going to be inundated with unsealed letters.
But they still have to be professional documents.
Right.
But letters?
Some of my letters are professional documents. If I'm issuing a letter of clarification on a code interpretation to a building official, I will seal that because that's a professional document. I'm rendering my professional interpretation and judgment on a code citation, and I will seal that.
And I will seal a change order on a when I do initiate a change order.
Well, how about if I add in on section 4 the words after change order to plans, contract, documents, or specifications, and then when the board as a whole looks at this, you guys can bring up
your
concerns or questions.
Okay.
And that'll give you time if you want to mull this over in your free time
to
maybe come up with some other suggested changes. So,
okay.
Mm-hmm. Is that fair?
Sounds good.
Okay.
And on public works projects, it probably is even maybe just there are some idiosyncrasies there because each profession has to seal because there are no incidentals.
And we don't even include that, do we?
No.
Right. We should.
So, public works.
Well, and actually, maybe there's some, maybe this is what you were saying, there needs to be some clarification, like on a spec book, we have a seals page that has every discipline listed, and each engineer listed, and then their seal goes on that page, and then there's a clarifying statement, this seal covers divisions 23 to 29, this one covers...
And we do that on... We do that on highway projects also.
Yeah. So you show design professional accountability for each of their bodies of work.
Uh-huh.
But don't we say that in the statute, the public works statute?
Oh, but the public works statute says it.
Right.
But you're talking about seals and the rules.
Then you want to include public works. I see what you're saying. Okay. All right. So I'll take a stab at that too, and then
because a major part of the work in the state is public works.
Yeah, and Alejandro will weigh in on that too, I'm sure.
Yeah.
So that I personally am going to strike 305, and I've kept it in just to humor Patty, but all the drug lab stuff is going to come out because by the time we get these rules through, it's there will be no more drug lab properties to clean, so.
So, I have a, this is really nitpicking. It's the last item on, it's on page 33, Appendix A, sample seals.
Mm-hmm.
The size requirement.
Yeah, somebody I have this no
up
idea.
Somebody brought this up years ago. We issue a lot of half-size sets.
Do you?
Oh. 99% of the sets that go out of my office are half size. Nobody wants a 30 by 42 sheet anymore. They want it shrunk down to half size. We just make sure the fonts are big enough. Technically, the seals on those drawings are not in compliance with the statute.
Well, now's the time to change it.
And maybe maybe there's a way to say, you know, the original seal needs to be this big.
That's the key.
That's it.
You know, but...
Because we look at every one of those that come out
and
make sure...
And nobody's getting dinged for this, but we're all of the same mind on that. Somebody down the road could look at it and go, you are not in compliance because you issued a half-size set of drawings.
Melissa, every highway project that goes out, the plans that go out and are purchased by the contractor are half-size.
So maybe we should provide for that here. We say sample seals, the original seal must be the following size with the outer circle being whatever and the inner
and
circle.
That, what Ed
and
said,
then we say...
It is permissible to issue reduced size, I wouldn't say half, I would say reduced size sets.
Reduced size
without,
sets.
Without modifying the seal size or something
produced.
Like that.
As long as the original was the correct size.
Okay, so reduced size sets may be produced without modifying the seal size, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
And then when the contractor starts building, he's got it on his computer, and he can pull it up to any size he wants.
The size of the screen.
Yeah,
I think it's good to include that because we want this to reflect the best practices now.
Yeah.
So, did you hear that, Bill?
No. Sorry.
So my concern was, you know, we have these very specific sizes for the size of a seal. Well, the theory was for legibility and things like that, but 90% of the documents going on in my office are now half-size sets. So now the seal does not comply with the statute or the rule. So we're just tweaking a little bit to say that the original size seal shall meet this requirement, and reduce size seals on.
Do we need
however
to,
we worded that?
Yeah. Do we need to do anything in relation to electronic sealing?
Well, that's covered pretty well actually. Okay. I looked back there, and it talks about it. It talks about you're being allowed to do it. It cites the statute for electronic signatures.
So anything there that could be clarified on electronic signatures would change the technology?
It's a little bit confusing.
It is a little bit confusing. Maybe that is something we want to look at because it used to be in here, and I don't know if it still is or not, but you couldn't use a scanned signature. That's, you know, I digitally sign all my drawings. I personally sign them. My my, it's in a PDF format. It is password protected. I apply my signature to every drawing that goes out electronically, but it's a scan of my signature that I overlay. Mm-hmm.
It's in 304 use of seals, I think C. In the event a copy, blah, 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 is sent to a regulatory body or person in any other electronic form and the document does not meet the requirements, the registrant shall mark the copy, electronic copy of final document, sealed original is with, you know, whomever the registrant is.
Yeah, and I actually wrote that.
You did?
I did. A long, long, long time ago.
Wow.
Yeah.
So what
because
I'm wondering, guys,
I was starting to do federal work, and we had to digitally, we had to issue electronic drawings, and the government was throwing my drawings out on the web without a signature on them.
Yeah. Well, what I'm wondering is the change you want to make to the Appendix A sample seals. Maybe we should say that in this seals rule, or are you happy with leaving it under reduce under the size of the sample seal?
As long
you know
as it's
mean?
Covered somewhere, I...
Okay.
Know.
Okay.
Since it's tied to the dimensions, I think
leave
maybe
it there.
It's better to clarify it in Appendix
okay.
A.
Okay.
Let me back up a minute, too, because I'm kind of thinking that we don't even need to address the reproduced size of a seal. You know, Ed, how do you know that you're looking at a half-size set of drawings?
Size of the paper.
It has
size
scale.
Of the paper. It has a graphic scale on it. And a lot of times, some clients actually require me just to annotate it. If this sheet is not 24 by 36, it is scaled. Or, you know, it's a reduced scale.
So to me, that's determined in practice. I don't think we have to write anything about it.
Okay.
You know, the size of the seal, the original seal's got to be a certain size, but if it's reproduced, it's reproduced. I mean, you can tell by the scale bar and the texts and the font size and all that.
I'm fine with that.
Okay,
we'll leave it as is.
Well, I'll put in the qualifying language. The original seal must be the following size.
Yeah,
I think that's good.
Yeah, that's good.
Okay. I think we're done. Unless you guys want to revisit the day, month, year of registration expiration.
I do not.
You want to make that argument
to
the
board?
I want to
get rid of it. I am fully prepared.
Okay. Awesome.
I don't think you would have much opposition.
I don't think so.
Yeah.
Maybe there was somebody that wanted it, but who knows?
I think it was Bob, wasn't it?
Yeah, and he's not here, so.
And
Bob's
good.
Not here.
And it's too confusing to the public you're dealing.
Yeah.
Do you gentlemen want me to make the changes and set it on a regular board meeting, or do you want this to come before the committee one more time?
I think we're ready to go to the board. We've got three
right.
of us here.
I vote
board.
For that.
Yeah.
Sounds good.
We need to do
all
a
right.
vote to transfer.
I am kind of concerned about APLS having the opportunity to lobby for their new standards, so I don't know if that plays into your question right now.
Well, this is the very beginning, Jason. You missed my whole little preface I made before you called. This is just the real beginning. We want it to go before the board, and then the board will probably weigh in with modifications. Obviously, APLS may come up with a standard by the time it goes to the board. Regardless, it's just the very beginning. We still need to send this over to the governor's office and ask for permission to enter into the rulemaking. And then in the rulemaking process, there's still opportunity for changes and modifications. So, you know, APLS probably has a better part of a year to decide if a new standard is warranted.
Okay.
And how would they be able to lodge their concern with the board? I guess agendize it,
contact you, and
all on a meeting?
Right, send me or address the letter to Jason, send it to the board, and we can put it on the next available meeting agenda for review and consideration and action on the new Apple's minimum standards.
Okay, great.
Okay. Right. And then that those dates get included in the proposed rulemaking.
Okay.
Okay.
And will you send out an email with the revisions that we discussed today?
Sure.
Thank you, please. And then I'll share that with Akela.
And I'd like to defer Neil's question again, because I have to leave. I have to be at a 1 o'clock meeting at 33rd and Camelback.
That's fine. He's lived this long.
I'll be fine.
I love how he signed it. K-N-E-E-L.
Yeah. Any other business?
Oh, I move that we adjourn.
Move to adjourn. Second.
Second.
All in
favor? Okay, thank
you, gentlemen. Melissa, I would like to acknowledge at our board meeting the passing of our first female board member.
Yes.
Yes.
First female board member.
Yes. And landscape architect.
That's
very
right.
Sad to hear that. I really liked her.
Okay, so we should put that on the agenda.
Do you remember Libba Wheat? She was first female landscape architect, first female board chair. Neat lady, landscape architect in Tucson, passed away the 13th from all.